David is coming in early, as you know, with our schedule on the floor and the uncertainty for going in the afternoon, et cetera, et cetera. It's been difficult to get to our agenda, but yesterday we made great progress. And so tomorrow, although we're scheduled at 7:30, we'll begin at 8 o'clock. So I feel comfortable with what we have left that we'll be able to accomplish that. As we look at today's agenda, let me point out that the first two matters, HB 2352 and HB 2937, we have completed. On HB 2226, we're waiting for amendments. Should have those later this morning. Same with HB 2307. On 2353, we took testimony on yesterday, so that is complete. 2801, we're waiting for amendments. 3304, we completed yesterday and sent out, thanks to the good work of Senator Courtney and Bill Taylor. On 3361, we're waiting for amendments. On that, we'll take additional testimony. And I am sharing with Senator Courtney right now the court's opinion in the Hooneman case, and I'll get copies for all of you. It answers some of the unanswered questions yesterday, and I think you'll understand why the court did what it did in that particular case. As we're always reminded, there is another side of the story. Who is that? Paul Harvey always said that. And I guess I'm the one who said the other side of the story. And then 3374, we're waiting for amendments. HJR 52, we'll wait until Senator Brown is here. And then the last three, this is what we'll begin with today. And I'll open them, I guess, the work session on Senate Bill 875. This is Senator Shannon's bill that would I'd like to send to, maybe she serves on this in general government.
Public affairs.
So the chair would move that we send Senate Bill 875 to public affairs as our recommendation. Any objections? This is the one where I tried to send it earlier, 2 weeks ago, but it came out 876.
Sure.
And it was the wrong bill and they weren't interested in it either. So we'll try again. We'll now go to the work session on Senate Bill 841. And this is Bill Lane Shetterly, and I began at the beginning of the session dealing with statutory victims' rights. And I agreed with the proponents of the HJR 87 through 94 to hold this bill until after we completed the HJRs. I'd still like to consider the bill for a couple reasons. One, there are important rights that we can do statutorily, and especially in the event if some of the HJRs fail, either going through this process or at the polls. So I asked for some amendments to be drafted, because I learned a lot by going through the HJRs. Mr. Chatter, can you tell us what the staff
amendment is? The exact same thing as 870
HJR, 870 with that stuff, and it's the same. It's the statute as opposed to the... And does it... and I think then this would replace the bill, wouldn't it?
That's correct. Yeah. What happens if both this and the Constitution this would just become moot?
It would, as a matter of fact, because the other would be in the Constitution.
It would have to be repealed then.
The next legislature probably would repeal it if it's not being necessary. Any discussion? Any? Senator Courtney?
No,
well, the chair then would move the dash one amendments to Bill 841. Second. Or the chair then would move Senate Bill 841 with the floor with the due pass recommendation. Second. I'll hold this till after the HJRs. I think it's important that we have this. And that was part of it. make the question. I would be the chair. We'll now go on to a work session on Senate Bill 1009. This introduces us to begin a discussion about allowing good time back into our criminal justice system. Under Measure 11, this isn't possible for Measure 11 offenses. But Measure 10 says you can amend Measure 11 with a two-thirds vote of the House and the Senate. I think it's good policy to allow corrections recognize the behavior and allow good time and third offense offenses. What, again, I've learned by going through the HJR 87 through 94 is that this would have to go through the sentencing court, and there were recommendations from, they put that some of the offenses that were in the initial bill be deleted so that it's the less serious offenses that would be, would allow for retention. So you have some amendments in front of you. Mr. Taylor, could you describe what those
are? Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 1 amendment limits second look to the following statutes and that includes two subjects and one office that is an attention to your other two. Thank you for the time and part of the plan. Allowing up to 15% of the time for a function reading program. The Dash 2 amendments, I think the Dash 1 came from the Department of Commerce, which is pretty typical of Dash 3. Dash 2 amendments remove following offenses, so obviously unlawful sexual penetration, unlawful sexual penetration, one, the force is not used in the victim of any 12.
So they basically eliminate all the sexual offenses, correct?
Sure, the committee basically eliminate the offenses that are nonviolent.
What?
Nonviolent. It's usually be there because of the age difference. The presumption of the lack of well, not the presumption of that. There's no consent because of the age difference. They're not like Rose Law Enforcement.
Okay, but by eliminate, you mean that they're not going to be covered by the bill?
Chairman, I'm saying that these amendments now, let's go to the
bill. Let me ask you. Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just clarification. Did I understand that the sexual offenses were not included as part of the bill? Did it take it out?
Gentlemen of the committee, they narrowed the bill from the original bill, which included, for example, attempts of conspiracy to commit murder, manslaughter in any degree, rape in the first degree. They limit the bill to just the attempts of police 9 through 13. 23, that's where the offenses are listed in the original bill, and they substitute it with the offenses you see in the amendment. So it's now considered a result.
Sure.
And these would adapt to the from a current direction.
No, I believe the Dash 1 already. I've gone back a couple of months. I think they focused here yesterday, but I think the Dash 1 are, I think they fall through the Dash 3.
Okay, why don't we do that just to make sure that this is good.
No, Pam is involved in the work group. It didn't produce much because there's 11 points. You know what I'm saying? In fact, the 11 is going to be in here tonight.
The 11.
Given everything he said about the minutes, are we still going to have to measure 11 times?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we couldn't get those with the materials because at that time, he was so committed to all these other ballots, all the victim stuff, and he didn't know where that was going. He didn't even want to talk, but I remember there seemed to be some interest around the table to look at this. I'll be very frank with you because I remember this work session very, very well. We thought we could do some wonderful stuff here, really, to create creative stuff that would be in the best interest. And that's why I was looking at that stuff up there other than that meeting that day, but maybe not. Maybe he didn't want to acknowledge it.
Thank
you. Sure, that's the problem with just limiting the the ability to use good time to reduce it in a sentence if it's only four, 1 through 4, and then 12 and 13. What happened to first degree theft? I don't see that listed in part of the bill.
This
is only applicable to measure on census.
That's
right. Okay. Okay.
On normal 11 census, they can use
that. They can still use it.
They can do that. That's the whole reason Bill King used, I understand, is they're already there on non-measure 11 cards, but this is for measure 11 cards. But that's what it was. Yeah, he didn't need to talk. But.
And in my first attempt at drafting the bill, which wasn't very good, I took out, you know, murder and all sorts of things, and I should have taken out from the beginning some more of the offenses, but being a business attorney, not a criminal attorney, I've been down the criminal attorney again after 6 months on judiciary.
We do a lot of things.
Criminal law attorney.
Right? Yeah, criminal law attorney.
I don't know that you're mean, but I just want to comment. I really believe in victims' rights. We were talking about that. I understand because you're a witness. But the recent publicity on the gentleman who was dying, and he's quite on back in prison. His parents are in town. They're likely to take him home to die, which is going to be soon. I just think that there's a point where the emotionalism of the victim gets in the way, and I don't know if we could ever deal with that. But from what number, there could be another side. I didn't understand that possibility. So it seems to me that something is wrong, that there's no way to release that. And just because
the mother
can stand in the way of that, one person, I just think there's something wrong with that kind of system. And with all due respect to the victim, I'm not trying to mollycoddle the perpetrator in this whole thing, but there's a point where he's not going to do anybody any harm at this stage of the game.
Well, ultimately, the state's going to have to take a look at a geriatric type prison situation, because even to have some very ill or very old Measure 11 people that, again, aren't at risk, but you don't want to keep them in an expensive institution.
Right.
And if you can create almost a secure adult foster care situation, it's less expensive. Plus, if they become what are known as disabled, the federal government will take it across.
Yeah.
Because they qualify for social security disability. So in future sessions, that's something you should look at. You can preserve the public safety and at the same time create a better system.
I'd rather have those guys pay for it than us guys.
I'm a sailor.
Chairman, the reason for the Dash 3 amendment is just to make it consistent with when the HDR is passed. One and two is if the court indicates that the person may be considered for reduction as provided in the last 137.75. But what this would require is the judge to open the court would have to say
that's consistent with the. I think we need to do that. Well, if that one is notified and wants to speak, they'd be able to do that with the sentencing court allowing for the good time. And that would be consistent with the HJR.
Is there any retroactive?
No, this is not retroactive.
If you got to sentence yesterday, you're off.
Except that if I think the court could, if the Department of Corrections wanted to award a good time in the future, for offenses committed on or after the effective date of the act. So you're right, you'd be out. It's difficult to make. Yes, this will take 20 votes.
You know, it takes 20 votes. We're going up the hill again. All of us are going up.
You're going to top that down.
The Marine Corps says we're all going up the hill.
It's all down here. Let me go.
So, the chair, Mr. Senator Courtney, if you'd withdraw your motion and do the dash 3, because it would.
Okay.
Do the dash 3 include this language, Mr. Chair? So the dash 3 would delete lines 9 through 23 and insert rape, sodomy, sexual penetration back in the bill.
Okay.
assault in the second degree, kidnapping in the second degree, rape in the second degree, sodomy in the second degree, unlawful sexual penetration in the second degree, or robbery in the second degree.
Well, what is rape in the second degree?
Yeah, off the top of your head, what is it, 164?
Sexual intercourse with a child from the age of 14.
I don't think we want to eliminate. Sodomy in the second degree. We don't want to eliminate that.
Good, Taylor.
Unlawful sexual penetration in the second degree. Why don't we come back
to that?
Adrian? I understand. What is unlawful sexual penetration in the second degree? Well, why don't we'll come back with eliminating 3, 4, and 5.
The ones are on board. Sure. Okay.
All right. Okay, Dr. McGee, and I think Senator Courtney.
No, I'm going to follow the chair up to here.
And recess until 1:09. All right. Senator Brown won't be here this morning, and she wanted to be here for two bills. What I'd like to do, we won't go into work session on those bills. Let's go ahead and discuss them. And the amendments on the one aren't ready yet anyway. So one of them.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Gee, may I ask Captain Schmidt to take place and talk to us briefly about 3374, about an issue of concern on that particular bill?
Okay. We'll go into a work session on 3374 and glance at that. This is what we're waiting for the amendments on, but on any of these we're waiting for amendments. If we want to discuss this, take testimony this morning.
And maybe the amendments will address it, it's just concerned that I think it would be good for us to discuss.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, for the committee, that's Bob Smith, Oregon State Police. If I could bring your attention to page 3, line, actually, it would be line 45.
The dash B's?
Yes, of B and Gross.
We're on 3374. B and Gross.
B and Gross bill, page 3, and section 4. And section 4 sets up for those persons that who intentionally possess a loaded or unloaded firearm or any instrument in a public building, then it outlines out who then may possess that, and then it gives down on line 34 with the exception of, and then it allows for an affirmative defense. And I believe it's probably just a typo, because I think the intent of it was as opposed to create a circumstance, which this bill does in current form. It creates the circumstances where for the sheriffs and police, for instance, under 2A, it would be unlawful for them to possess a firearm in the public building, but it would just give an affirmative defense to that. So if we would go as a remedy, go to line 45, and under subsection 2, go 2D. 2D, I think, is where the committee intended to go, which was, then for those that carry a concealed handgun, there is an affirmative defense.
Yeah.
I may have lost
Generically explain what this amendment would do.
Generically, what I'm asking here for consideration is, under the current way that B is drafted, what it does is it says that it would be unlawful for police to be in possession of a firearm in a public building, and then it gives an exemption, and that's why line 45, it gives us an affirmative defense to being in possession of that firearm.
An affirmative defense is not the same as an exemption, right?
Correct. It would allow police to be charged for unlawful possession of a firearm in a public building, and then it would actually give us an affirmative defense for possessing that gun in a public building.
That makes sense.
I thought in some situations, police were required to carry their weapon at all times. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, yes, we are required. And in courthouses, in those public buildings, in the performance of our normal duties, we are required to carry firearms at all times.
You are?
Yes, sir. And so what we would ask is that, and I think the remedy would just go to allowing for the affirmative defense to only go those that are carrying a concealed weapon under the ORF. In other words, line 39 on page 4.
Because it should not apply.
It should not apply to police.
So the exception creation is for those who have a concealed handgun permit.
Correct, sir. Right.
You're interested in saying, if the number of state senators I found out who put a house in the concealed weapons permit when they're in the building and they have gun zones, they're still going to be allowed to come into the Capitol with the gun zone, is that right?
Well, there's Senate rules and House rules.
On the floor. But they can walk these halls, they can do stuff. In fact, several of them have shown their weapons to me. They write as they, and everything, they are armed. They are armed. Well, that may be, but they're armed. And I can tell you, I warn you now, and I'm warning you. And you, I'm warning you, and you, I'm not warning you, but I'm warning you, and you, you will have a very interesting caucus meeting if you go into your caucus and say, guess what, it's off limits, state capital is off limits to anybody with a concealed weapons permit, the exception of state police and law enforcement.
And to be honest, I think this is one of the cases where it could be done conceptually instead of having to move back to the LC.
Oh, it could be.
Okay. I just want to raise that concern for the bill.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Any questions?
I'm trying to help you. I don't know why you never help me, but I'm trying to help you guys.
And this applies to any public building. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes.
What are we doing, man?
Mr. Chair, Dale Penn from the DA Association, Dave Ainsbury from the Department of Justice is also with us. And to talk about this bill, we need to kind of give you an overview, because this is just one section. We agree there could be a very simple amendment to cure this problem. The reason for this bill is that there was a court decision which stated that if you're going to prosecute someone for not having, well, for having a concealed weapon, it ordinarily would be if they had a permit for the concealed weapon, they would simply show the permit and then they wouldn't be arrested, they wouldn't be prosecuted. So let's say somebody had a permit, but they didn't have it with them. That's still a violation under the law. You've got to have the permit. The difficulty was they would be prosecuted for not having a permit. And if they had a permit, they would just simply show that, because that's the way it operated for years and years. A few months ago, the Court of Appeals gave a decision that said the state must affirmatively prove that someone does not have a permit. Now, the practical problem with that is that means we're going to have to bring in every one of these prosecutions someone from 36 sheriff's offices saying that in this county they don't have a permit, and in this county they don't have a permit, in this county.
How many statewide permits are there in the state?
Well, Mr. Chair, each sheriff is authorized to issue a concealed weapons permit. So to really cover the state of Oregon, we'd have to have some representation from 36 counties.
But I heard somewhere that there are 86,000 concealed handgun permits in the state.
Mr. Chair, there are a large number.
Sheriff Tunnell had issued a permit in Coos County. Could you drive into Curry County with your permit?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'm center jumping, yes.
Just drive out by the state of Oregon again.
That's a whole different issue, but we're talking about in the state of Oregon.
And if you'd been on our committee earlier,
I would love to.
You would have known, because we dealt with that. Well, that's right.
We're doing
that. And that isn't looking that way either.
So, Mr. Chair and committee, the reason for this bill is to go in where there are places concerning concealed weapons permits and establish that it is an affirmative defense if you have a concealed weapons permit. Because you're supposed to carry it with you when you have your weapon. And since we cannot practically prove that you don't have one, the only way you can do that under the criminal law is to make it affirmative defense. Now, in this particular section, Section 4, we agree that the way this got drafted is too broad. It was not the intent to go into that whole subsection and say all these exemptions are now affirmative defenses. We simply wanted to take 2 sub D, which is the concealed weapon part, and make that a affirmative defense. So if we would simply say in line 45, the exception listed in subsection 2 sub D of this section constitutes affirmative defense, I think that would...
We might want to just, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Ainsbury, Department of Justice. We did discuss this earlier, and maybe Mr. Penn, this will refresh your memory a little bit. But the problem we ran into is if we applied it only to holders of concealed handgun permits, then you have somebody who says, "Oh, I was in the military on active duty. Prove I wasn't." And so that was kind of the dichotomy. You know, it's easy for a policeman. I mean, practically speaking, a prosecutor is not going to prosecute a policeman who's in uniform with his badge and his gun. And I think that's sort of where we were in hashing this out. The problem is you don't have just law enforcement officers, but somebody who could be in the National Guard and show his ID card and say, "Well, I was on active duty." He doesn't have to produce orders. We have to find out what unit he was a member of and find out that he really wasn't. So I think the practicality of it, we thought it would be easier for law enforcement to prove out of hand. I mean, they can just show their badge or anything, and they can prove it really isn't a burden on them to make the affirmative defense, but it's a huge burden on the state to prove that they don't fit under any of these exceptions. So I know at first blush it looks like a tremendous burden, but practically speaking, in light of that decision in Brust, it's going to be a problem. You'll have a guy, if you take out the concealed handgun permit, the very next guy is going to say, he'll just get the list. All he needs is a sharp defense counsel to find something that's difficult to prove.
In order to use an affirmative defense, does there have to be a charge filed? I mean, do they have to actually charge a police officer?
They would, yes. So, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, my understanding is that practically speaking, a prosecutor is not going to charge a person who has a past affirmative defense, such as being a police officer. But that is maybe what the committee wants to consider, where the burden should lie. Do we err on one side or on the other?
Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I'm listening to your testimony, Mr. Ainsbury, I'm wondering if it might not be easiest to get everybody where they want to go to simply say that C, D, and F are affirmative defenses to A and B or not. A and B, which have to do with whether or not the
defendant is a peace officer, or summoned by a peace officer, that seems fairly easy to prove from a prosecutor's perspective. Officer would take a person, a peace officer,
CDENF all seems to be some of the concerns you've raised.
Would that get you where you want to go to do it that way?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Horton, I believe that that's a good compromise. We don't want to, our intent is to be able to prosecute in these situations with licenses when someone is not licensed. And that would be a good compromise. I agree, it's rare that we would be charging under A and B anyway. So I think that's a good.
Mr. Chairman, that would satisfy our need as well in that compromise.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that would be a problem at all. I would also suggest that maybe Section 3 receive similar treatment because they have, that applies to a different section of the statute, the carry of handguns not in public buildings. And that has the same laundry list of who's exempt, and the only affirmative defense created is for the person who holds the concealed handgun permit. That would be under Section 3 of the bill, line 26.
So we'd have to do the same up there,
gentlemen, it isn't, I'm honorably retired. I hope it's honorable, but I'm retired. So this wouldn't help me out at all. I could get nailed for going into a county courthouse back in my firearm concealed. Because it doesn't matter, doesn't give any exemption for 160, which says that if you're retired police or parole probation officers.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Turner, I think what the suggestion was on Section 3, that 166-260 section, was to put similar language that the affirmative defense applies to C through H. And A and D, again, would remain exempted, which is sheriffs and whether honorably retired or not, so that would still remain an exemption. And the affirmative defense would apply to these other Army, Navy, concealed weapons, they permit.
Okay. We're waiting for some other amendments on 33742, correct?
That's my understanding from speaking with counsel.
Yeah, that's right.
However, if you want to come here, you can have some help.
All right. That's fine. I want to get to the testimony on 52 this morning because that's why Mr. Chamoff here and your representative. Who else would want to testify on 3374? And Dave has additional testimony 52. Why don't we complete this testimony and then we'll go into 52. Yes.
What is the purpose of the Section 3 addition of the concealed handgun license holder? What does that do, adding that? And I do understand the intent is to keep it as an affirmative defense on the page 3.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, that language was essentially taken out of Section 1. The statute as it currently reads says that, or proscribes carrying a firearm concealed upon the person without having a license. And the court in State against Brusk said that the state must prove you don't have a license. So that portion was taken out and placed in the list of exceptions to the statute and determined to be an affirmative defense, so a person with a license would have to come forward and prove that he held one.
Okay. Do you have other testimony you'd like to offer on 3374?
Mr. Chairman, yes, thank you. Just briefly, we have provided to members of the committee the B-20 amendments. Those relate to the first section of the bill. We had a case that came out from the Court of Appeals, I believe, week before last, State against Williams, which suggests the existing language of the statute, which the current statute provides that it's illegal to carry concealed and readily accessible to a person with any vehicle which is under the person's control or direction, any handgun without having a license to carry. Now, because of Brusk, we have to take that without having a license to carry and make that an affirmative defense. the problem in Williams was we had the passenger with the concealed handgun, but he wasn't in control of the vehicle, so the statute didn't apply to him. So under the current statute and state against Williams, the passenger is in a drive-by shooting situation, as long as they're not caught shooting. If they're just carrying the weapons concealed, the statute doesn't apply to them. They're not doing anything illegal. They don't have to have a permit. I don't believe that was the intent of the legislature, and the Court of Appeals winked at it, but said that's the language of the statute. Exactly. However, upon further review of that decision and the language of the statute, it only prohibits carrying concealed and readily accessible within a vehicle. And our concern is if somebody has it under the floor mat or is sitting on it or shoved under the seat, perhaps he's not carrying it, so he still might not be affected by the statute. The proposal in the B-20 amendment would replace the carrying with possessing a handgun that is concealed and readily accessible within a vehicle. He would still have an affirmative defense of a permit, but that would, we think, broaden it to cover the person who sticks it in the map case aside or has it in the glove compartment and might not actually be carrying. So we would urge your consideration of the B-20 amendment.
And Mr. Chairman?
I agree.
And this would also apply to the passenger?
That's correct, Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick. If we make it possessive and the rest of the bill is passed as written in that section, then it would be any person in a vehicle who possesses a handgun that is readily accessible and concealed. So it broadens it somewhat, although it does not broaden it tremendously because it still has to be within a vehicle. There were some concerns by potential opposition that it would be extremely broad, but it isn't. It's all within a vehicle.
Questions? Thank you. Ingrid. And Dale, did you have anything you want to add on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, this is Sitting Ingrid Swenson, I'm President of the Plans Association. Is the committee entertaining all of the proposed amendments at this point, or just some of them?
Not 21.
All right. I would like to address, if I could, the B-22 proposed amendments. These have to do with joinder and severance of criminal cases, and I suspect they're in response to an Oregon Supreme Court case, State v. Miller, 327-11-622, which was decided in 1998. Currently there are what would be considered, I think, fairly liberal joinder rules in this state. Basically, the state can join in one indictment and have jointly tried cases that have similarities either because the victim is the same or the time and place and circumstances are similar. Your case involved two sex cases against two different victims. The time period was very similar and they overlapped, but there were two distinct victims, and the defendant moved to sever these because he felt his interest in one case would be prejudiced in the other if the jury knew that there were charges against him in another case. In addition, it was his intent to testify in one case and possibly not in the other, so that he would be biased by the jury's knowledge that he had spoken only about some of those issues. His motion to sever was denied, and the Supreme Court upheld that denial in his case. It did discuss the rule for severance, and basically the rule requires that the defendant show that his rights will be prejudiced by a joint trial. And the discussion in the opinion has to do with what prejudice means, and they looked to the legislature and said, well, prejudice means that one of your interests is affected negatively. So by these amendments, the state is seeking to raise the standard by which trials are severed and allow them to be severed only where it is, quote, clearly inappropriate
to have them tried together. And if the court would also be required to strongly consider the victim's interest in the trial of joint offenses. From the information that my members have given me on the practice in this area, it is an extremely rare case where a judge grants a severance in any county. And when they do so, it is under circumstances where there are competing interests, and those defendants strongly outweigh those of the state. There just does not seem to be any need for correction here. When we're talking about one victim, I think in almost every case, the court is particularly concerned that the victim not have to be present for two trials. But the Miller case, for example, involved separate victims. And while it was a convenience to the state to be able to try these together, there really was no greater interest than that at stake. And despite that, the court denied a severance in that case. So, on the contrary, I think maybe we should be moving in the other direction and recognize that fairness requires separate trials more often than they're granted. But to move it in the other direction seems clearly inappropriate.
And again, you were addressing the dash.
B-22, yes.
Is there no opposition to the B-23s and B-25s, which I understand are intended to eliminate some language that was declared unconstitutional?
We have not taken a position on the 23s, and I'm sorry, the other one?
25.
The 25. That's correct. No opposition to either of those.
Dale, would you like to address the U-22?
Yes, Mr. Chair. First of all, Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney from District Attorney Association. This bill, we strongly support the original bill, and it is designed to deal with the problem of drive-by shootings that we have in a number of counties, and we are unable to prosecute passengers who are possessing the guns and using the guns unless we catch them in the act of shooting. And so this change in the statute would allow us to prosecute passengers, because typically that's the way it is. The passenger is doing the shooting, the driver is the only one who can be charged, and then usually the facts are such that we cannot charge the driver. So we think it's an important bill. You've heard the discussion about the Brusk case, and so the need for the affirmative defense for the concealed weapons permits. Another very important change that we would ask you to consider is the Dash 22 amendments. And let me give you a little history on this. It was probably 1989 session. I may be off on this, but I worked very hard to put into law the federal rules of joinder. And since that time, we have had these rules of joinder. And it's a very good policy choice, because it saved us money, it saved us time, and it said that we would have one trial rather than multiple trials. Oregon had gotten to the point where all the federal rules and most other states had extensive joinder of cases. But Oregon was out here basically saying for every charge will be a separate trial. A very expensive system. So, in the 1980s, we passed and adopted the federal rules of joinder, which changed it and said the rule is going to be, we'll have one trial. If the defendant is substantially prejudiced by that joinder, if in fact that he really does have two diametrically opposed defenses to these charges, well then they will be severed. But that will be the end. That's what the federal courts have adopted. And we put in, as legislative history, all of the federal case law up to that point, and the system worked very well. The Court of Appeals reviewed cases and adopted those federal standards. Everything was going fine until the Miller case.
And ironically, the Supreme Court said that severance was not appropriate. Joinder was the right thing to do. However, the problem is they looked at the statute and they said, what is all of this discussion about this term substantial prejudice? We know that's what the federal courts have used, and we know that's what the Court of Appeals has adopted as the test. But the statute doesn't say substantial prejudice. It says prejudice. It's a new concept. And so this is exactly how Oregon originally got off on a whole different analysis of joinder, because we had the same test 50 years ago that every other state did. And so now we are very concerned that we are changing the standards here. And already in some counties, trial judges have looked at Miller and said, you know, I know what the law was, and I used to say there's got to be a real, there's got to be a good reason for severance, but now we have this new standard. And so they're starting to sever more and more cases. We're starting to move to a separate trial for every charge. We believe this is a very cost-saving thing in the indigent defense system, in the entire criminal justice system. We want to stop this right now. And we can do that by bringing in the term that the federal courts and the Court of Appeals have always interpreted this to say, and that is substantial prejudice. So that's the reason for the Dash 22 amendments.
Yes, but I think Dale would help me. I mean, you talk about cost saving, and I understand that. But also, you could address the fairness concept.
Yes, Ms. Chair and Senator Duncan, I think the Miller case itself is a good example of that. Because what happens in these things is we're going to argue these points, and the defense is going to say, well, this might hurt me. You know, I might do this, I might do that. And what the Supreme Court says, you know, that's not good enough to get up here and say you might. You've got to have real prejudice here. Now, we're calling it prejudice, and the Court of Appeals used to call it substantial prejudice, but it's got to be something we can grab hold of and we can look at and we can say, yes, you are prejudiced. And it's not just maybe kind of stuff. That's my simplistic analysis of it. And if a situation comes about where a defendant truly is prejudice, that I have a real defense in this one, and I have a diametrically opposed defense in this one, that's one of the situations where the federal court and the Court of Appeals said, yes, there is severance. They should be allowed to use those different defenses. But not that, gee, I just don't want them tried together, which is really the underlying complaint. Keep in mind, in the federal system, in the vast majority of the states, they are jointly tried except when a defendant has a specific concrete reason for prejudice. And that's what we're trying to reinsert.
I could ask that same question.
Thank you.
You're being an appellate judge here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Duncan, I think Mr. Penn has just articulated the issue very well. He said the Supreme Court found that it's not enough to say I might be biased, I might be prejudiced. You have to show that you are. Now, they took the language that the legislature gave them, which was prejudice, and they read it exactly the way Mr. Penn would like them to read it. And if the lower courts at some point say, well, we don't agree with what the Supreme Court has found, the Supreme Court can correct that. But in Miller, they have very clearly said that this person, whose circumstances to me absolutely, in fairness, require separate trials, is not entitled to one because he didn't show prejudice, even though there were entirely different victims with entirely different sets of circumstances, and one case in which he anticipated testifying and another in which he did not. If that doesn't rise to that level, it's hard to imagine what legally would.
Ingrid, in looking at the DAF 22, putting in substantially prejudice is what happens on line 19 and 20. And then 23 to 24 and then 1 through 3 on page 2 are the meat of it. Do the words that are proposed in this amendment correspond to what the court said in State versus Miller?
They did not use language, as far as I know, Mr. Chair, which is clearly inappropriate or strongly considered. And my assumption is that if the legislature were at this point to change the language, the Supreme Court would have to read that to mean you want a higher standard, because they have read the standard you gave them as extremely high already in terms of the defendant defeating that requirement and getting set to trial. So if you change the language at this point to strengthen it, the Supreme Court obviously has to read that to say, you know, we're just not allowed to sever unless the Constitution is implicated here.
Well, here's the two words that I circled it. I don't, probably the court didn't use, and that was clearly in the before appropriate strongly before considered. Ken, how does the language that's proposed in Section 4 differ from the Miller decision?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that this simply brings into play the consideration of the victim in making this decision. We primarily would like to see the change up on line 19. We think this is appropriate in the new sub 4. I wouldn't have a problem if the committee felt it was appropriate to pull out those two adjectives. Our main thrust is we made a real effort to put legislative history in when we adopted the federal rules of joinder to say, this is what these words mean. Here is the case law. Here is the discussion. We had extensive memos we put in. We believe these amendments would accomplish that again. And if those adjectives are too strong, we wouldn't have a problem.
Well, under the federal joinder rules, are the victim's interests considered?
Mr. Chair, the idea of having a single trial so that you don't have a victim having to testify in multiple trials, yes, that is a consideration.
Minor point, you're supposed to be magistrating those two different entities.
Oh, we definitely don't want to do that. Yeah. Coming out of this community. And where are the entities?
This is clearly inappropriate.
I know.
And shall strongly consider.
I was going to suggest deleting clearly and strongly. That's just a little
Sure. One additional comment. In one of the statutory bases for denying severance is that the same person is the victim. So I think even though it's not articulated as considering the victim's interest, that is the whole reason for denying severance and requiring joinder under certain circumstances.
And of course, joinder can't defeat the purpose of having a fair trial.
Well, if you're talking about due process standards, federal constitutional law, that's how far you have to go. If you're talking about a constitutional limitation on right to fair trial, but as Mr. Penn pointed out, in this very case, the Supreme Court finds that just the possibility of unfairness is not enough to amount to prejudice, and they articulate that. They say trial court found that the defendant may not wish to testify regarding one of the events, which include that the defendant alone is not an actual showing of prejudice.
Ms. Chen, it would seem that subsection 4, when you delete clearly and delete strongly, if you add the word substantially prejudice, that's already how the court interprets it, correct? So it's a little icing on the cake, maybe, but it's not really necessary, is what I'm asking.
It just is a statement of legislative purpose of the importance of victims in the system.
Thank you. Other comments on that? Thank you. All right. We'll return to this on the other amendments already. I would like to just begin a discussion on measure 52. So we'll close the section 3374 open board session on 52 and invite Representative Patridge and Mr. Chamon. Committee,
we shouldn't have or shouldn't pass out some information dealing with two new proposed amendments. And they should be in our packet.
Which
on 52.
Which bill would represent the veterans interested in?
In which bill?
I know.
I also think in your packet you should receive a memo from the same day, 29th, concerning the dash 19 and the dash 20 amendment. So, limited in this amount will be invited also. The chair has normally after I hear information and weigh the arguments, I can make a decision. I've been troubled on this one. I like to give the committee direction and say this is the way I'd like to go and the reasons why. But this one has been a challenge to me. And part of that challenge relates back to the fact that we've referred this matter out twice in different forms. It's been defeated. I supported both of those referrals and voted for them, but obviously the voters who voted disagreed. But there is still an organized demand for communities to be able to do something in this regard. So we took a look at HCR 2 and HCR 52, and keeping in mind what has failed in the past, and that even if you don't like the business, it's a lawfully protected business under our current constitution, that we allow cities and counties to go in the direction of 52, concerned with protecting those existing businesses. And so we tried with the idea of the dash 815 that grandfathered in these businesses. That's been objected to by the sponsors, saying that they don't deserve any more protection than other businesses have where the zoning has been changed. The 19 and the 20 tried to offer some comfort in that regard, saying that they won't be regulated any differently than other non-conforming uses. This was a suggestion offered by the city of Portland. The concern that the chair has, that I still struggle with, is what would stop a city from saying, okay, we have these non-conforming uses, we have an ordinance dealing with non-conforming uses, and we're going to change that ordinance to say, if it's a sexually oriented business, that we're going to amortize those non-conforming uses and they rezone over in this other area that obviously is a different location from where they're located now. By passing A19 and A20, can a jurisdiction do that without addressing their other non-conforming uses at the same time? Let me give you an example. You've got a bar in an area that as a non-conforming use because of the zoning change, or you have some business that's located in the area that's now residential, but it's been there forever, so it continues to operate. If we adopt 19 and 20, could the jurisdiction just rezone and direct their attention on the sexually oriented business, or would they have to address those other non-conforming uses at the same time in order to meet the intention of A19 and 20? Mr. Chamoff, what are your thoughts on that question?
Mr. Chair, it would depend upon the meaning ascribed to either in the A19 other similar land uses or
within the same zoning classification. There was probably a non-Google rule to have it apply either way. Either the local government could classify
adult businesses as the one class, or they could make a larger class that involved all commercial establishments or commercial establishments that serve adults. If your intent is to require local governments to move out all businesses that are not sexually oriented businesses but are in some way like sexually oriented businesses, then I think that the language would need to be somehow more
friendly. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, I agree.
What about the situation where you, because this whole effort is aimed at sexually oriented businesses, so what if your intent is to say that, okay, if we're rezoning the sexually oriented businesses somewhere else, and in another arena we are rezoning some commercial areas to some residential or vice versa, to treat the sexually oriented business rezoning the same as you would treat another rezoning. That's I think what's trying to be accomplished. In other words, if you don't, the example that was given by one of the city commissioners to me last night in Portland is the gas station in downtown Portland. Well, gas stations aren't allowed in downtown Portland, and they have been zoned out of there, but this is a pre-existing use, and the gas station is still there. So, you know, would this be treated, would this have a faster or amortization schedule than another non-conforming use in another area? I think that's what Twitter shows, is they're not treated differently from other, at least that's what I would be interested in, is that they're not treated differently from other non-conforming uses that are not sexually oriented businesses.
Your intent is to have a non-conforming, sexually oriented business treated the same as a gas station, then I would recommend that you try to fine-tune some of them. I'll make more specific what in other similar land use or within the same zoning classification. I believe that the A-19 and the A-20 amendments could be interpreted to give the local government the authority to decide what can be considered a class, what is not a similar land use. So the local government, in your scenario, could say that gas stations are not similar to sexually oriented businesses. They are not within the same zoning classification as sexually oriented businesses.
Securities now that have the authority outside of Oregon to create a price for these places. Their ordinances, how do they generate those ordinances read? The following uses would be permitted in an industrial zone. Is that how it usually works in those communities? The states which have the greater authority, the local government would be here to do this. Every city has a certain number of businesses that are in non-conforming use status. I'm going to speculate in the state of Oregon. I'm going to say I'm kind of non-conforming. And I remember when we went through an incredible rezoning of property in Salem because the city council, we put together a comprehensive plan out living commercial. We rezoned property from commercial down to residential. And all hell broke loose, but we did it. They said you couldn't do it, you were taking all that. And we did it, and we survived it. If you simply, today it's a conforming use, tomorrow it's a non-conforming use, the property still, the business still remains, correct? It's just non-conforming.
Right. Correct.
All right, it remains. It's just now subject to anything that a non-conforming use is. I don't know where Rob's on this. We can do that, right? There should be no problem with us being able to do that. Because that's just like rezoning a piece of property out of even if there's no building on it, from one zone to another. Let the property owners may scream and say, you're taking away my profits, you're taking away my value by making me go from commercial to residential, etc. Because I've been all through that. But I believe that's legal. So, okay. So we can do that. So now, where else are we going now that you...
And in your situation, correct. And in your non-conforming use, the reason you can do it is that existing business that no longer
conforms with the new zoning can continue to exist.
All right. And Rob, you want those properties moved out of within some reasonable period of time. Is that correct? Is that your intent that the maker of this representative Thatcher's is the maker of this resolution?
I have no intent to move the existing sexual businesses. There's been no intent expressed. I know that there was some concern that the city of Portland expressed that they wanted some kind of amortization. I went back and listened to testimony more than once. I gave a copy of that to the chair. I think Senator Burdick had conversations with the city of Portland. I know the city of Medford has no plans to do that. Not only does it not make sense from a cost perspective, from a city's or county standpoint, it really doesn't make a lot of sense, because not only if you're going to have some kind of amortization schedule, there's a lot of sliding legal costs and other things to go along with that. I think what the primary concern, the concern that I bring this forth with, is because of the fact that we want to have cities be able to zone these types of businesses where it's appropriate for the city. For example, in the city of Medford, we've moved to having what we call community commercial. So we're spreading out our commercial instead of having it in one corridor that creates lots of traffic problems in a land use situation. We're doing community commercial. So we have small neighborhood like community stores or grocery stores abutted right next to neighborhoods. We're trying to provide, that's probably not the best place to have a special oriented business. If this were to pass, we would be able to say that that's not an appropriate use. I don't think that there's been any intent expressed by myself as the proponent nor anyone else that's out there as to what's going to be amortized or if there's any plans to amortize. And I don't think that this has been proven anywhere else in the country that there has been some mass exodus to come amortize these types of businesses. The only place that there's ever been a problem is, for example, in a recent New York case that was upheld in the Times Square case, all these businesses were there and had all kinds of contamination problems, and they had to come in and take those apart. But that was I think that was a much more aggravated situation than we were ever getting to.
And to get it narrow the issue further, and Senator Courtney's heading in that direction, is what I would want to avoid is allowing this to pass. That, let's say in the city of Medford, that city commission would say, okay, we're going to rebrace the zone for sexually oriented businesses and all non-conforming uses have to move there and adopt an amortization schedule, which is a case-by-case situation, in order to have that happen without doing the same thing for the other non-conforming uses, because then it would be just targeting. So I have no problem with the idea of passing this, and then in the future you go ahead and zone the way you want to on where the businesses would be located. It's only on the existing businesses, having them targeted and being told, and they'd be the only one that would be amortized, lose their non-conforming right, and say, you've got to go into this area. That's the concern I'm trying to address.
I don't necessarily do that with every other kind of land use policy that we're able to do. We move businesses to industrial zones, we move businesses to commercial zones. We do it based upon the land use laws that we have in the state of Oregon, based upon the traffic patterns and environmental issues that go along with those traffic patterns, as well as roads and facilities that go along. I don't think that there's any evidence in the record or any evidence that's been presented that will do this, that will unfairly target these. In addition, I want to make clear that these businesses have rights that other businesses don't. For example, in Monmouth, where Senator Courtney is right there with Western Oregon University, they don't have any bars. They're a dry town. You can't do that with sexual-oriented businesses. Cities must provide a place for them to be under the First Amendment. They not only have that additional protection. So I think it's a local control issue. That's why we framed the issue the way we have. There's no evidence anywhere that that they're going to be unfairly targeted, and I don't think it's from a practical sense it makes any sense, just by nature of the cost, the court cost, and by nature of the legal cost. As I testified previously, the city of Nissa right now is dealing with a situation where they have over 300 complaints at the present time. They don't have the money in their treasury to even hire the city attorney to fight this case from a nuisance standpoint. You have a lot of towns that are on the edge across the state.
Now,
Well, 52 could help, Mr. If they have them all, they can lump them together or spread them out and do other things.
But
and it can also help others.
Well, if you have to zone for it, it's going to be on the little corner somewhere. And
okay.
But
I think that's an issue that's out there, and from a practical standpoint, it doesn't make sense.
Well, I'll convert that question. Then we'll go to Mr. Linden and Mr. Tadanki, who's moved up to the front.
In light of all that you've said here, would it be fair to say that your intent with this is prospective, in other words, for future, for citing future businesses?
Absolutely.
And that you are not trying in any way to prematurely dislocate sexually oriented businesses or relocate.
Precisely.
Mr. Chairman, for your record, Bill Linden, if I could quickly go back to your first question about the A19s and 20s, I agree completely with Mr. Chamoff that those two phrases, other similar land uses and same zoning classifications, would permit any jurisdiction to so define them to target these types of businesses. I'm not sure there's words that can be devised that would avoid that possibility. The only scenario I could understand would be if you had a city decide that every single non-conforming use in that jurisdiction was going to be amortized. You know, then you're affecting this type of business potentially as well as all the other non-conforming uses. Now, as a practical matter, it's difficult for me to think of a scenario under which a city would decide to do that, because non-conforming uses are you know, pretty prevalent and you find them in many, many jurisdictions. The point that I would come back to in terms of further discussion, if in fact the intent is to provide cities with an opportunity in the future to zone these businesses in certain areas and not in other areas, and there is no intent to affect existing businesses, the -15 amendments, that language, that one sentence, makes it very clear that that would be the effect. And I don't have as much faith that no city would attempt to use amortization to move existing businesses out of locations, ultimately out of business. I mean, we've heard the largest city in the state tell you that they will oppose this measure if the -15s are adopted. And what the -15s do is basically take away an opportunity for that city to affect the existing businesses. Now, if they don't intend to affect the existing businesses, I don't understand that type of objection to that particular amendment. Again, it's just one sentence saying what we have now is not going to be impacted, and in the future, jurisdictions will be able to make decisions about where to put these businesses. And that appears to me to be a clean, understandable approach to putting in place a new zoning scheme for sexually oriented businesses.
And I can...
Yes, Jeff. Yeah. As like Sherry said earlier, he'd been really wrestling with this mess, gone back and forth, ping pong ball, times on this particular walk. But I guess the thing that bothers me a little bit when I think of the -15, we maybe talk. I know which one is. Are we talking about -15 really right now?
Talking 19 to 20.
Right. Okay. All right. So I'm okay. I just want to be sure I'm sure your name. It seems to me that you're getting almost a lifetime, the lifetime of the amendment, we'll say, protection that no other business would enjoy. You couldn't completely rezone and move something out, but that one business seems to me like it would be protected, and no other business has that same kind of protection. And that's my concern. Do you want to address that particular part of
it? Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, I'll attempt to do that. The way I look at that question is simply, what other type of business has a constitutional amendment being proposed to provide special regulation because of the nature of the business? I don't think that it is unreasonable to assume that if this measure were to pass, that there would not be efforts made to not only zone these types of businesses into different areas and their traditional bit in, but also to target existing businesses to move them out of where they are. I mean, you know, this is a very difficult type of business to cite in any kind of a a public participation process. So they are being targeted by this measure. And as a result, I think that they ought to have the assurance, since they were nothing, they were totally lawful in terms of their original fighting and establishment, they ought to have the protection that they will not be targeted under the terms of this measure because of the type of business, the content of the business in which they are, of which they are. So they need an additional protection because of the targeting involved in this measure.
Another question, not exactly on that one, but let's just look at this right now. Under this is the bill the way, well, with any of them, with the ministry of evil within it, you know, could NIFSA have an ordinance that would not authorize any new equity specific businesses in the community?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, I think that NIFSA would have to, they couldn't prohibit any additional types of businesses like this. What they could do, if you know, geographically they could do it. I'm not that familiar with how this is laid out, but if they could, they could create an area within the city limits in which they make it permissible for these businesses to be present. I mean, that's what any city would be able to do prospectively under the terms of this measure. You could decide that that location is not okay and this location is okay. And I think they'd have to, like any other municipality, go through that same type of process. But, you know, some municipalities in Oregon, you know, just their sheer size will make it difficult to do that, but it's not impossible.
I did have one question. If we could work with the 1920 amendment to make it clear that cities could not treat sexually oriented business and for purposes of amortization differently than they would treat gas stations for rezoning that affected gas stations, if there was some way to work with these amendments to make that point. Because I have the same difficulty, so a little different perspective of putting any particular business in the Constitution. That's why I don't like the measure itself. But that aside, if that could be accomplished, where the rezoning affecting sexually oriented businesses would be treated the same as rezoning affecting other kinds of businesses in different zones, would that be something that you can work with?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, it's certainly something to talk further about. I'd like to talk perhaps with Mr. Chamoff. I think the only way to do it and make sure it's unfair is you'd have to provide that cities can only address non-conforming uses in sort of a blanket manner. So in other words, if they decide to impact one non-conforming use, that decision means they are going to impact, probably through amortization, each and every non-conforming use in the jurisdiction. And the part about that I'm uncertain about is whether, in practical terms, that would ever happen. But you certainly could draw up language that would require that. I'm not sure the cities would be too...
No, I don't think they would, because as a practical matter, it would end amortization for any large community as a practical matter. At the same time, it would protect the non-conforming uses that are there. So that would be straight up.
So, but Mr. Chairman, if something could be worked out that, for example, if the city were to be able to go in and show, yeah, we've got this 5-year amortization schedule for sexually oriented businesses, but we also have a 5-year amortization schedule for this other class of rezoning. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at, is just, so these businesses aren't targeted because of their content.
Mr. Chair?
Thanks.
Thank you. For the record, David Fedanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. This is complicated because you are tinkering with the Bill of Rights, number one. Number two, you are tinkering with the relationship between the state and local governments by adopting HR 52. But that is the whole purpose of HR 52. And I would like to remind the committee that the campaigns against Measures 19 and 31 did not only focus on the lack of protections for free expression under the First Amendment or the narrow reach of protections under the First Amendment of the Federal Constitution. They also focused on what can occur when you let loose 276 different jurisdictions in the state to adopt different standards and different methods of implementation. And that is the heart of the problem. What HJR 52 does is to say to a class of businesses, which are now guaranteed the same protection as any other business, which is that they cannot, businesses cannot be regulated currently based on the content of the expression that is taking place in that business. You want to carve out an exception and allow for harsher treatment of a class of businesses based on the content of the expression. Now, if you carve out that exception and you don't contain that exception very clearly, and you're giving greater authority to cities and counties, then you are essentially allowing cities and counties to have one rule for other types of businesses and lots of different rules for this type of business. And that, I think, is the heart of the problem with this issue of what the effect will be on existing businesses. There are some protections under Oregon law now for non-conforming uses, but it depends, whether there's any protection at all for non-conforming uses, depends on what city you're in and what county you're in. The city of Portland testified that they currently protect non-conforming uses and allow them to continue. But this amendment would allow them to make an exception to that general rule and target sexually oriented businesses for closure, consistent with the federal constitution. So every other kind of business in the city of Portland might be able to continue its non-conforming use except sexually oriented businesses. And I understand, Mr. Chair, you're struggling with how to say that they couldn't do that. And I think it's difficult without adopting something like the Dash 15. I don't know how you can do it, because the inherent problem with this amendment is that you want to allow harsher treatment of sexually oriented businesses.
Senator Carter.
You know, I don't agree with a lot of things that are being said about non-conforming uses. And I've dealt with it firsthand. Cities all the time say to a business, okay, we're going to allow you to exist doing what you were doing, even though you shouldn't have been doing it, but you've been doing it for 10 years, and we just found out it's in violation of a certain zone, but we're going to change you to a non-conforming use. And then tell them, hey, that means you do any of these things, the business is gone. Or they allow a new business to start out as a non-conforming use thing. Ordinarily, we wouldn't let you go in this zone, but we will, because all the residential places haven't developed yet around you, and so we're going to let you go in. But if the residential areas develop, we figure for that time, your business will create certain traffic problems, and you're under the non-conforming use standard. I've been through hours of hearings, no decisions as a member of the San Francisco Council in 6 years. I wish we had a city attorney in here who really understands this non-conforming use. Because all kinds of statements are being made that this can't be right. We're discriminating now. And, you know, you talk about you're going to unleash 276 cities. David, what do you think you have out there now? And I see it, first of all, they recognize an existing business which has nobody, it's sort of snuck in there overnight, but it's been there, and you've got an old farmer, and you don't want to put him out of business, and you catch it. So you say, okay, well, you're a non-conforming use. Or they let him start to move as a non-conforming use. So I don't understand this whole bit about, in this area alone, they're going to do things with non-conforming uses that are being done literally today involving a lot of other businesses or services that exist throughout the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, generally,
non-conforming uses, in my experience, are allowed to continue as long as they don't step out of certain bounds.
Correct.
The passage of this amendment, that treatment is not required by the federal constitution. You've heard testimony that the federal constitution permits shutting down non-conforming uses as long as you amortize over a period of time, which could be anything as short as 3 months or as long as 3 years, depending on the individual business. And what Oregon law relating to non-home rule counties provides protections for non-conforming uses in non-home rule counties, okay? So it wouldn't affect any county that's home rule. It doesn't affect cities. But that standard is similar to the standard you just discussed.
If you make a non-conforming use, you don't shut them down. But that is an acknowledgement of their existence, David. That's the whole thing. That's why you develop a special thing called non-conforming use. Rather than say black or white, up or down, you allow them to continue to exist under certain restrictions, if you want to call it that. But that's the whole idea of a non-conforming use designation zone or whatever ordinance in your city to deal with this stuff. So I'm not talking with you at all on this one.
The point, Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, is that, number one, the city of Portland testified a couple of weeks ago that their adult business zoning ordinance that was overturned in the Tideman case departed from their normal rules for non-conforming uses and provided for shutting down existing businesses with a one-year amortization period. That, we believe, is the type of ordinance we would see a lot of unless this committee is very clear that the same non-conforming use policies that cities and counties apply to other businesses are also going to be applied to sexually oriented businesses. And I think it's an issue of a question, in large part, it's a political question for all of you. If you support this resolution, do you want it to pass? If you build into it the same kinds of defects that were built into Measures 19 and 31, you doom it to failure. I've said before, and I know you're aware of it, Senator Courtney, ACLU is going to oppose this measure regardless.
Right.
But I think as a practical matter, how you deal with this issue of existing businesses is going to determine whether or not we have a viable campaign against this measure. And, I think HR 52 is a bad idea, but I do think there are things you could do to it to improve it, to lessen the damage, if you will, the collateral damage to the Oregon Constitution and to our system of fair laws in Oregon. Mr. Chair, just to conclude, I think one of the critical things that this committee needs to do if it moves this out is to adopt the -A8 amendments, which we have A8, which would insert the language online.
The A8
online slot. I hope that everyone, that will lessen a lot of the collateral damage that this measure would do, but it will not eliminate the collateral.
I will go to, I know you're,
Mr. Chairman, Mark Nelson, representing Oregon Entertainment Corporation. I want to try and put this in perspective. 52 would not be here today if there wasn't a desire to zone in certain areas adult sexually oriented businesses. It wouldn't be here today if it wasn't the desire of the proponents to move existing businesses. Now, I take Reverend Patrick at his word. The city of Portland clearly has stated that they want to move sexually oriented business. Now, I think Senator Courtney is correct. You can take the example of a gas station. We have a gas station in downtown Portland. It's a non-conforming use. And it hasn't been advertised. It hasn't been moved. The city of Portland doesn't amortize other non-conforming uses. City of Portland intends, and you can ask the representative here today, intends to amortize these particular non-conforming uses out of business. In other words, they will create a zone for sexually oriented businesses someplace in Portland that we haven't seen yet. Someplace in Portland, and thus making the existing businesses non-conforming, just like the gas station. But that gas station is going to stay there.
Probably Portland would have agreed to you until you out of the phrase, out of business.
I'll take that back. That they will say you are a non-conforming business, just like that gas station. But we're going to amortize you, and we're not going to amortize that gas station. Nor are we going to amortize any other non-conforming use in the city of Portland. Because the goal of this measure is to move and hopefully put out of business by some those businesses out of where they currently are. I mean, there's nothing magic about this, Mr. Chairman or members of the committee. This is the purpose of the bill. The purpose of our amendment in Dash 15 is to say you can't do that to existing businesses. You have to leave them there until they go out of business, they burn down, and they can't rebuild, they can't expand being a non-conforming use. But the purpose of our amendment is to protect existing businesses. The reason why it's being opposed is because they don't want to protect existing businesses. It's that simple. So if you do not adopt Dash 15, you're saying you do not want to protect those existing businesses. And there's no other way to look at it. The city of Portland has said they will oppose File Measure 52 if you adopt our amendment. So they are saying if you allow existing businesses to be protected, we're going to oppose the measure. So what is their purpose? To eliminate existing businesses. It's that clear, Mr. Chairman. It's that.
Right. I guess the city of Portland's representative is here today, and as I told you and gave you the tape, there's been no expression from the city of Portland that that is the case. I think they've responded to Senator Burr that is the case. All I can say is I'm opposed to Dash 15 because they're overbroad. I've stated the reasons previously why they're overbroad. They create a whole second tier of land use policy. I don't know what else to say to the committee in regards to the A15. I think it does create a whole second tier. I don't think it's good public policy to do that. You have to remember that when we look at the Oregon Constitution as well as the federal Constitution, we have to look at them in concert and together. I would again direct you to the memo that was done by Mr. Shema, who is our legislative counsel, in regards to both the Fifth Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment that make these businesses be treated equally with other businesses. In addition, I would also refer you to Article 1, Section 18 of the Oregon Constitution, because I would urge you to adopt the A8 amendments, which we've talked about, which is also a takings clause, and also requires that these businesses be treated equally if an amortization should occur, or if any kind of takings should occur, whether it be you amortize or you actually have to come in and buy the business like they do with all the other kinds of businesses. It's appropriate, it's reasonable, and it's rational based upon what our land use policy is in the state of Oregon, what's been done on other states throughout the country in 48 other states. There's been no showing that these are going to be improperly targeted. And I just urge you to move forward in regards to these amendments.
Jamie, you've been writing some things down here. Do you have another option for consideration? Senator Burr, do you have a question?
Yes, just a brief question. You would not object then to something, because this is an Oregon constitutional change, and I understand your point about the protection of the federal constitution, but you would not object to language that requires local jurisdictions to treat, for purposes of amortization, to treat these kinds of businesses in these kinds of zones similarly to how they treat other kinds of businesses with other kinds of non-conforming uses.
Senator Burke, what I would tell you is I think it is unnecessary to put an amendment like that in, because they're already protected under Article 1, Section 18 of the Oregon Constitution, as well as the Fifth Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause under the 14th Amendment. The only thing that you would be doing is defining what is a similarly situated business would be the only change that you could make in the constitutional language, which I don't believe is appropriate. I think
especially from a constitutional standpoint, because of the changing nature of business in Oregon. It's a way for a court to look at and see if that's what's necessary to see if these are similarly situated businesses. I think it's very difficult to put some kind of statutory scheme in the Constitution when there's already adequate protection. I think the Constitution is there for a reason, and I think those protections are already provided. The only additional thing that you could add is how you're going to define what a similarly situated business is, and I don't think that that's appropriate based upon the changing nature of our business and the changing nature of Oregon in terms of its growth and other things to place that in the Constitution. It's just not appropriate from a drafting standpoint either.
Just to clarify, my intent was not similarly situated businesses. To me, that means other sexually oriented shops. But my intent, and the source of my question, is other non-conforming uses, you know, businesses that may not be similar, but are, you know, if the city's going to amortize some non-conforming uses, they're not going to discriminate, they're not going to target gas stations, and they're not going to target sexually oriented. That's what I'm trying to get at, if you would be comfortable with that kind of language that would prevent any business from being targeted.
I'm not comfortable tying a city's ability to shape their future and shape what they want their community to look like. So, yes, I would be opposed to the fact that you would have to say everything is amortized equally, because I don't believe that that's constitutional either. You have to treat these businesses like similarly situated businesses. You'd not only be, you'd be transgressing, I believe, and you can talk to Mr. Chamoff, but based upon first impression, you'd be transgressing upon what we already have in the 14th and 5th in terms of protecting these businesses, in terms of similarly situated businesses.
Then perhaps you could help out a little bit. Well, how would you define a similarly situated business?
I think you've got to look at the economics of the business, how long it's been there. I think we gave you a legislative council opinion from the last time that has, I don't have it sitting in front of me, that had about 7 different things that courts look at in terms of a similarly situated business. I think it's too difficult to build a scheme within the constitutional framework. I think there's lots of things that need to be looked at, probed, and examined when you do a similarly situated business.
There's an element that came up in the consideration on the Mr. Chamoff, what do you have for us?
Well, Mr. Chair, as we've been scribbling away at trying to come up with some language that gets to where we think Senator Burdick is heading, I can see Judge Beatty rolling over in his grave, but the language that we've come up with in an effort to limit a local government's ability to pick out sexually oriented businesses for what I would call special amortization. We've come up with a language which is similar to the A20s, which is a political subdivision that adopts an ordinance for non-conforming land uses under this section being the amendment that you'd be referring, must apply the ordinance in the same manner to all non-conforming land uses and the amortization of non-conforming land uses within the same or similar zoning classification. That would at least prevent a local government from having a single zoning classification for sexually oriented businesses. There would have to be some broader class. I'm not sure how much more precise we can get in a constitutional amendment. There would certainly have to be some fleshing out of what a similar zoning classification was. I think it would be the same process as Representative Packard has explained, that the court would apply under existing constitutional provisions, but this would at least make express what's implicit in the other constitutional protections.
Why don't we ponder this? This is the new language. And at the same time, as I mentioned my other concerns, I don't want to stop a city, say, this is an opposite example, where it's now a commercial zone and there's a residence in it.
and that resident should file up to the plan of the city as this commercial zone is located. I don't want to stop them from saying, okay, we're going to amortize this residential area, and certainly that might be different amortization schedule, different weight on the criteria for what is reasonable than it would be in a business situation. So I am sensitive to that type of approach too, and I realize it would be difficult. So why don't we take a look at this other legislation, and I think we do need to make a decision at 2 o'clock this afternoon.
I want to add, I really, these witnesses are not the ones you should be listening to now, these little minutes. I want the city to look at this because they deal with these things almost every city council meeting, and I want to know, you know, they have to deal with their communities and with, you know, their growth and economics, and I want to know what we're doing here just in the name of China. We're talking about a specific type of business versus all kinds of businesses, all kinds of residents, all kinds of industrial businesses out there they have to deal with. So we're going to do this in the Constitution. I want to know where the cities are and this doggone thing. I hope cities are listening. I'm just talking about the city of Portland. I'm talking about the League of Oregon Cities, the Mayor of League of Oregon Cities, here talking about what is going down here.
I hope they're here at 2 o'clock. Also, at that time, take up 6 and the other bills that are on there.
Mr. Chair, just for some clarification, we're trying to get some people. I'm pretty interested. I don't want to have to go back to 15 unless you want me to bring people in on 15, 19, or 20, or you just going to do a new one.
First of all,
they should be here.
Social Security is on the new guy. We'll come to that later. Right now, the committee has received the dash 21, 22, 23, and also a suggestion from Mr. Linden that I have here, which is not an LC form. It's the conclusion of our meeting this morning. Senator Courtney invited cities to come forward and offer their comments, and I see that we have that today. Jay, why don't you walk us through the amendments that we have?
Mr. Chair, this is the dash 8, which is what they have this morning. You have before you the dash 821, which are, as I understand it, the language that you can have there for you. And I believe that 822 and 823 represent the one or more cities.
Why don't we have Greg then explain to us just the difference between the three amendments, and then we'll take the testimony from the committee. We also have a letter from City Medford's attorney. I know we're all surprised to see that, but it did arrive. And then we have a conceptual amendment.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council. The A21, 22, and 23 amendments are all intended to do the same thing. There's variations on the same theme, which is to come up with language that would require a local government, if it intends to phase out an existing adult business, to do so in the same way that it would phase out other similar businesses. And we
tried a couple of different variations to come up with language that is understandable to the largest group of people possible. It would probably, for your purposes, be most useful if you invited the folks from the city of Portland up to talk about their suggestions with A22 and 23.
Why don't we have the city Portland come forward then? Who would that be? Some of Louie. I guess I'll make some more copies.
I do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pete Caffey, the Deputy City Attorney for the City of Portland. I'm the chair of a technical resource. I have some experience with zoning and land use issues. I'm here to respond to questions.
My name is Bob Cannon. I'm representing the League of Oregon Cities. I'm a municipal lawyer in the Mid-Willamette Valley. I represent several counties and cities and special districts in this area. Again, I'm a resource to the county, to the committee. Wish my input.
Everyone wants to be our resource.
Good.
Well, we have some questions concerning non-conforming use and cities' policies towards non-conforming use. So maybe we can start with that. You're all familiar with HR 52 of the proposals that we have. And the concern is, if we don't put something in HCR 52, then a city might decide to amend their non-conforming use ordinance and zone an area for these types of businesses and then go into an amortization process where all the businesses have to go locate in that area. Talk to us about that and what would be involved.
Let me just add to that.
Exactly.
I don't want to get so fundamental, not to insult anybody who's talking from the committee. What do you mean by a non-conforming use that is some of the conditions that you attach to it in your respective city? You just see one city, but you know several cities. Just garden variety, or this city that says non-conforming use attaches these things to it, if you know what I'm saying. And I think you need to act like, to make it feel like city council people, because I said that's the thing I tried to bring to the discussion this morning, because I had a service from city council, that we were giving you getting the impression, we were speaking very academically and theoretically about non-conforming uses. I want you to bring some realism to the word on every Monday night or every afternoon basis from your counties or cities and meetings. So I didn't mean to enlarge too much, but I want that discussion to take place.
And a final opinion, if you could offer this.
You've gotten the first question right now, Mr. Chair.
And we don't read the question. Is whether or not the proposed A-21-223 do anything
necessary,
or are those protections already there? So who would like to be A? Let me go. You want to? All right. Let me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, senators, let me start out with some background I think would be helpful to you, and it will follow up on Senator Courtney's comments and questions. As Marion County Legal Counsel, I have actually drafted such an ordinance. It was done in the 80s. It was done before the United States Supreme Court or the Oregon Supreme Court had issued any edicts in this area. The ordinance prohibited this type of business in relationship to schools and churches and playgrounds, the normal and usual suspects when it comes to businesses that will impact children. That ordinance was held unconstitutional, basically, by the Oregon Supreme Court's decision. Prior to the Oregon Supreme Court's decision, however, there were two decisions out of the United States Supreme Court. Both decisions, basically one out of Detroit and the other out of the state of Washington, put down the following principles. First of all, that these businesses are lawful under the First Amendment. Two, if you are going to zone for them, you have to treat these businesses as you would any other businesses, because they are a lawful use. However, in the Detroit case, the city of Detroit had said, we are going to zone these businesses into a certain area. And the opinion actually uses the red light district concept. So cities, prior to the decision of the Oregon Supreme Court, had two choices in counties in this state. You had the choice of treating these businesses equally across the board as a permitted use, but you could put conditions on them, i.e. X number of feet from churches, playgrounds, schools, etc. Or you could say that these are issues that only need to go into IL districts, which are light industrial areas. You had choices. The Oregon Supreme Court basically said that those principles did not apply and the United States Supreme Court decisions were not binding on the state of Oregon, and Oregon had a separate constitutional provision that basically prohibited any cities or counties or special districts from zoning this type of business in any different manner than any other business. So, that's essentially where we find ourselves today after many years. And then I'm going to turn to Pete to talk about non-conforming uses.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to just briefly describe what these terms mean because they are technical terms and people might have different ideas in their mind about what they mean. Now, I'm going to be using the Portland Zoning Code as an example here. Non-conforming uses are dealt with through local zoning regulations, and those do vary somewhat from place to place, but the basic concepts are the same. As defined in the Portland Zoning Code, nonconforming use is, and I quote, a use that was allowed by right when established, or a use that obtained a required land use approval when established, but that subsequently, due to a change in the zone or zoning regulations, the use or the amount of floor area of the use is now prohibited in the zone. So these were validly established under the regulations in effect at the time. The regulations change. The use is now nonconforming. That has consequences under the zoning code. In Portland, there's about a 10-page chapter of the zoning code that talks about the rights and the obligations attached to nonconforming use status, deals with issues such as the right of a nonconforming use to continue operation, the rights and parameters under which a nonconforming use may change the character of the use, like going from one nonconforming use to another, the rights and limitations on expansion of nonconforming uses, that you have a business that's a nonconforming use, the business has grown, they would like to expand on site, to what extent can that be done. Loss of nonconforming use status has to do with things like what happens if a nonconforming use ceases operation for a period of time, is it viewed as abandoned, what happens if there's accidental destruction of that nonconforming use, can you reestablish it then, what if there's intentional destruction of the nonconforming use, what are the rights that flow from that situation, and then there are other specialized provisions that aren't really relevant to you here having to do with things like nonconforming residential densities. So regulation of nonconforming uses is typically something that is handled in a general chapter of the zoning code that talks about all different types of nonconforming uses. And again, it becomes a nonconforming use by being validly established under the regulations in effect at the time, but then having those regulations change. The next question that you were asking had to do with amortization of nonconforming uses. That is a legally permissible option in most states. I think it has been followed or used infrequently in Oregon, but I think it would be available in Oregon. I brought along a treatise on zoning. It's the Rowland Zoning and Land Use Control Treatise, which is probably the most widely regarded treatise on zoning and land use. It says that courts in a majority of the states do recognize the validity of amortization ordinances, and then this will come as a real surprise to the lawyers. The test for the validity of those ordinances is whether they are reasonable. just reasonable. There is a little bit of elaboration discussed in the treatise. Let me just read two or three sentences. One test the courts have used to determine the reasonableness of amortization provisions is to examine the length of the amortization period in relation to the investment made. Another test for determining the reasonableness of an amortization provision is to examine the relationship between the length of the amortization period and the nature of the nonconforming use.
Yes, I agree.
Can I talk about this? What does that mean, the link between the demonstration and the nature of the use?
What it means is that the court will look at the particular business and see whether the amortization period is going to allow that business a adequate period of time to recoup its investment. And there's another section in here that talks about the particular aspects of the business that a court might consider, but it includes things such as capital investments that the business owner has made to develop the site, the mobility of their inventory, the existence of long-term leases that may or may not be something that the property owner or the business owner can assign to others, those sorts of things.
Chairman, so by the nature of the business, they're not really making any restrictions on what the substantive nature of the business is. It's more like the economic nature. Is that correct?
The determination of what is a reasonable amortization period for the business or the use depends very much on the facts surrounding that particular business or use. And that's going to vary depending on the nature of the business or use. For example, if it's an amortization ordinance relating to signs or billboards, there will be one body of evidence that talks about the cost of constructing billboards and the value of those billboards and those sorts of things. If it's an amortization ordinance aimed at junkyards or wrecking yards, which is another context where amortization occasionally comes up, that's a whole different set of factual issues. Likewise, adult businesses or any other kind of business, that would depend on the facts surrounding that business.
Where does profit come in?
I don't know the answer to that question. Let me take a quick look.
Try to answer?
Yes.
The real issue here, from my perspective, is that local governments will be very hesitant to go down this road of the concept of amortization. And the reason for that is if the amortization schedule is incorrect, improper, or unreasonable, you have, under the Oregon Constitution, inverse condemnation, you have a direct taking, you have civil rights complaint under 42 U.S.C.A. 1983, and as a result of that, the businesses will be able to recoup if the amortization schedule is improper or the government has acted improperly, not only their costs, but also the potential for damages plus attorney's fees.
On the civil rights action, what would that be?
That would be a taking of the Fifth Amendment.
Okay. So it's, I understand.
Senator Cornyn, so I'm really, you anticipated me. I see. Everybody's saying the 800 pound gorilla is Portland. I don't know what's going on in Portland. But to the best of my knowledge, the Medford, the Salem, the Eugene, the Baker City, the Port Allen, amortization is not very common. Is it in your experience? Your experience, how activities you have in Portland? I got to leave you over. I see you bodying this. I don't want to look at you, Portland, right now. You got to think of it. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, you're absolutely correct. In my, I don't know, I've been practicing since 1972, and I've never done an amortization, and all I represent is local government.
Yeah, and you know, I could swear, 6 years ago as a film city council, I never even heard the word. I heard non-conforming uses like crazy, and we zoned it, all kinds of things to hate it, and try to burn a house down for and recall a court. But I don't ever recall an amortization, so this word has become an unnatural act, an unnatural word for me. So you're saying, basically, my instincts in front of me on this in life. And even Portland out, or whatever they're doing up there. Is that right?
You're absolutely correct.
Yes.
I know, I should listen to you. Right. And Portland, have you done an amortization?
Not to my knowledge. I've been with the city for about 12 years, and I do not recall having seen any amortization ordinances in Portland in that time.
So wait a minute. I thought you had an amortization ordinance.
I am not aware of it. I was talking to U.S. Marge before earlier. I think she was investigating whether there were amortization ordinances prior to that. I think in the last 12 years that I've been in.
So I ain't going to rush you. My question was, not to determine the problem, do you have an amortization ordinance? That's different than whether or not you chose to use it. Which one of those two do you have or do or what?
We do not have any amortization ordinances in effect.
Cool. Well, Mr. Chairman, wasn't there an amortization ordinance that was overturned or an action under it was overturned? Before I'm looking through my file here.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that was the issue that Marge Kapori was trying to get additional information on. If that was the case, that was before I got to the city, so I'm not familiar with it.
The city staggered?
Huh? Kaiser, what do you want to Kaiser?
No, Kaiser moved the Portland case.
Okay, 1988 Portland case.
Okay.
That was predated you,
1988. Yes. So, Mr. Chair, I did find some additional information about the factors that are considered. Again, reading from the Rowan Treatise, some of the factors enumerated by the court to be considered in determining the constitutionality of an amortization ordinance are the reasonableness of the provisions in light of the nature of the property owner's business, the improvements erected on the land, the character of the neighborhood, and the detriment suffered by the property owner. There are some citations to cases here which I haven't read. I would assume that loss of profits would be regarded as a detriment to the property owner. That's just my interpretation of the Rowan Treatise.
Mr.
Chair, I'm a little bit confused. You're talking about billboards and so forth a bit earlier.
Those were examples of contexts where amortization could be applied and has been applied across the country.
Okay, not Portland.
Correct.
In your opinion, if did go through and the city of Portland were to amortize adult businesses and the adult businesses could come in and make a case that was unreasonable because their content was the reason for the amortization and nothing else, in your opinion, would that fulfill would they have a case?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my understanding is that the purpose of the HJR 52 is to allow the adult-oriented character of the communication to be used as a basis for regulatory activity. So my understanding of HJR 52 is that they would not have an argument based upon singling out adult speech or adult expression because that's what HJR 52 is intended to authorize.
Mr. Chair, to follow up, so then if they did, if they were a non-conforming use and they were treated differently than other non-conforming uses in other zoning situations, then in your opinion, would they have any kind of a case to fight that amortization? In other words, if the city decided to amortize those and no others anywhere else, would they have a case?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we would have to look at the legal theory on which the claim is asserted. I'm assuming that by your reference to treating them differently, you are contemplating a claim based on Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution, perhaps the quality of privileges and immunities. My understanding of Article 1, Section 20 is that it does not provide a basis for a claim unless the regulation that contains the differential in treatment deals with what the courts have called a true class. And the phrase true class refers to groups that exist by virtue of independent existing criteria and factors rather than exist merely by virtue of their grouping together in the legislation being challenged. So I think that's a complicated answer, but my initial reaction to your question is that it did not sound to me like it would be a valid Article 1, Section 20 claim.
So, Mr. Chairman, if we wanted to keep adult-oriented businesses from being treated differently from other non-conforming uses in other zones, then we'd have to make some provision for that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it depends on what you mean by being treated differently. On one level, they would be treated the same as everyone else under HJR 52 because, like anyone else who's subjected to an amortization requirement, they would be entitled to a period of time that allows them to recoup their investment so as not to suffer a taking. They would still be protected from experiencing a taking, even under HJR 52.
Mr. Chairman, but they would not be protected against, I mean, you both said that this amortization is seldom, if ever, used. And if it were suddenly to be used just for this one type of business, that they would have no protection against being singled out in that way. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the answer is no. They have protections under the federal constitution. They cannot be prohibited from existing. There has to be a zone into which they are able to move. There actually has to be a place for them. And if the decision by the local government is unreasonable or violates their due process or the opportunity to be heard or takes property without just compensation, they are entitled to compensation and they are entitled to sue and it would be very successful. This concept that is suggested in Amendments A, 21 through 23 is really difficult because it creates the concept that this is something that is practical for local governments to do, and I would suggest to you that it's not practical for local governments to do. It's very foolhardy for local governments to go down that road, and if they do go down that road, they would suffer potential significant losses. The other thing is interest condemnation or taking under both the Oregon and federal constitutions is not covered by local insurance. So this is something that local council would be very hesitant to recommend to the city council or county commission.
So your general advice to your client is go ahead and do the zoning, but don't amortize a non-conforming use. Allow them to continue to exist until they no longer exist as a non-conforming use.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if HJR 52 were to pass and go on to the people and be approved, that would be my recommendation.
And under the to the amendments, it uses the same base zone as the sexual oriented business. What is a base zone?
I don't have a fog, Mr. Chair. I don't have a foggiest idea. The real problem with A21 through 23 is it's adding terms into your constitution. Let me put on another hat. I'm the person who does the work for the former Dean's Committee, and in the order pamphlet for the last two times that we've had initiatives on the ballot, the former Dean's Committee has come out in opposition of initiatives because those types of things ought to be put into statute rather than the Constitution. It's called constitutional clutter. If you add terms into the Oregon Constitution which are not part of our common law or statutes at this time, I don't think that's a good idea. And so, not only as a lawyer, but as also representing LLC, we think that HJR 52 is okay as it is. And if you add items to it which create new terms and new concepts which have no basis in our current law, I think that's unwise.
You're going to give me a definition of what case is not going to be really included in constitutional
district. Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Base zone refers to the fundamental zoning district in which a property is located. The word base zone appears in that draft to make it clear that it would be applying to, for example, all businesses located in a commercial district or an industrial district or something of that nature. Base zones are distinguished from overlay zones, like design review zones, historic preservation zones, resource protection zones, and that sort of thing. So, in fact, the property may be within half a dozen zones, but the one that would matter for purposes of that particular draft is fundamental zones, such as industrial or commercial.
Okay. There was one other proposed amendment that's not an LC form. This is proposed by a
blown out of the water.
And it affects other zones. Mr. Chair, I have a response, and so does Mr. Cassidy.
Okay.
My response is, I think it might be the same. You're putting the Constitution, you're putting into the Constitution of the State of Oregon a large chunk of the concepts that we currently have under statute. I think that that's constitutional clutter. The other thing is, this may very well affect a whole lot of other things that aren't really relevant to HJR 52, and that's a concern.
Mr. Chairman, to me, that's basically my reaction as well. This looks more like local zoning code language than constitutional language.
Thank you for your testimony. Other questions? All right. Committee, I think we've explored this issue very well. I've learned a great deal. We have an opinion earlier from Greg Chamoff that said the dash 19s and 20s, he felt, do not add anything to the protection that's already existing. I imagine, tell me if the A 21, 22, 23 would change your opinion anyway. So, yeah, I think that would be considered constitutional quarter two then. No, you don't have to answer that.
I'm going to raise the AR 52 to 4.
We have to be AA. We are in agreement on the AA.
Yeah, there's one more.
Oh, the last two days. Alright, we know the AA, so what's the other one?
The other one is AA 9. Yes, AA 9.
To the what? Well, okay, but let's do the AA.
I move the dash AA amendments to HJR 52.
This will probably be the only amendment that there's consensus on. Is there any discussion? Objection to the
passage. Chair, we've geared up the campaign for this. We've got everything in order to go on the November ballot. We're the proponents of this. I'd ask that it remain within the existing legislation. That's what I'd ask for. It's been amply debated, ample time, and we're putting it, and we put that together. That's why we brought this forward. We changed it and amended it in the House to this language so that if we have a November election, we can do it then. Otherwise, if we don't, then it'll be in May. I'd ask that the committee stay with the proponents on that.
Yeah.
Can I ask Representative Patrick's question? One of my goals here is then to try and increase our credibility with the public. And one of the ways I think we do that is by really looking and taking a hard look at what voters have done in past issues. And you weren't here last session, but we have a little issue called Death with Dignity that was sent out to the voters again. This would be the third vote on this issue. Don't you think we owe it to the voters to at least do it at the time when more of the voters will be voting?
Well, Senator Brown, I think we also get, we also have a problem in that as legislative leaders in not responding quickly enough to what people have asked. The people who have been proponents of this have asked to be in the November election. There are several other issues that are there. This is much different than those previous ballot measures. That's why it was tailored the way it was. We eliminate a lot of the same arguments about the banning of books and other items with restricted zoning. So I guess I would respectfully disagree with you.
Yes, sir.
Do you really know what this is? Other issues for the
so we have the potential of HJR going. That depends on whether or not these three little ballot titles and that other bill we have in front of our committee. And then there's one other issue, defense of marriage.
I think the kicker in the Constitution may be, I don't recall from today, but the House just passed that out this morning, and depending on what the Senate says, that's set for November. If there's not a November election, it would roll over, and that's the way we set up this amendment. I consulted with legislative council specifically on that issue to make sure that it would roll over if we didn't have a November election to the next available.
Oh, I just would hate to have it end up being and then having to talk to the
legislature.
I don't want it to drive.
Mr. Danke, Mr. Linden, if you could come up also and address the dash 9.
Sure, just from a procedural standpoint, we as a legislature must be standing and have to pass legislation to have a special election. And so if the legislature chose not to pass that special election legislation, then
this will be rolled over to the next ballot. So
I know, ladies, you have to set aside $1.2 million to handle the cost of the election in the
It will be a subsequent. It would be a subsequent election.
When would the special election be?
November 2nd.
Again, for the record, David Sedanke, ACLU of Oregon, the -9s are one of our amendments. And if you are not going to do anything about the grandfathering language, then we strongly support adoption of the A9s. We understand that you would want to move up the election if there were grandfathering language. But if there is not, then we agree with Senator Brown that it is a major poke in the eye of voters to accelerate the election on this issue. The same thing was said about Measure 31 that is being said about this measure, that it was different from Measure 19, that there would be people who would support it that hadn't supported Measure 19. The voters rejected Measure 31. You will just be handing us an additional issue to use to defeat this measure if you put it on a special election ballot this year. I don't think you want to give us any more issues than you've already given us today.
Chairman, for the record, Bill Lindy again. Our client's the position is a little different. If the -15s are adopted, then the election day makes no difference because there will not be a campaign of any real size. So we sort of have a hard time answering that question until the other issue has been dealt with.
Assume the -15s aren't as amended.
Are not
adopted.
Then it ought to be at the general election in the year 2000. Just like the other two were.
Or this one would move it to May if we took out the language. If the -A9s are adopted.
I don't have the A9 in front of me.
It's the least line 12 through 18 of the credit and growth bonus provided for the special election.
It's a regular general election.
Regular general for the
2000. And Mr. Chair, there will be significantly more voter participation in November 2000 than there will be in either November this year or May of next year. May of next year, if particularly presidential primaries have already determined who the nominees are going to be, may be a very low participation election.
The other factors, too, to consider, if the ballot title for the HJR being victims' rights does not become law, either because the parties can't agree or the governor vetoes it, then that goes to the general election in November also.
Not necessarily, Mr. Chair.
Isn't that true, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chair, I believe that, there is a procedure under current statute for the Attorney General to write the ballot titles if the legislature doesn't.
But the question of when the election would take place, the Attorney General would write the ballot titles with appeal to the Supreme Court, but I believe that would occur in the next general election.
If that's a concern, Mr. Chair, you could adopt special timelines for ballot titles on HRs 87 through 94 to ensure that they would be prepared in time for the November ballot.
Well, there is a bill to do that. It's just that we don't know if it's going to make it through the process.
Right.
But as a default is what I'm saying, is those would occur then on the next.
That could happen in another bill, is what I'm saying, Mr. Chair. The bill that actually sets a special election, which is a separate bill from the ballot title.
And we have that bill in front of the committee. Not on this one, but on the HJR.
Right.
Okay. Other question?
I moved the -A9, but Senator has already done that.
No one has moved. Senator Brown moved the -A9 to HJR 52. Is there discussion? Why don't we call roll?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator
Move.
Senator
Bryant? Bryant votes aye. The motion carries. I don't think we have any other amendments that have a majority vote. Just to set to my preliminary polling of the committee, so the chair then would move HJR 52 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Discussion? Are there objections?
I'm going to object at this point.
Right. Please indicate Senator Burdick and Senator Brown is objecting. Passes. I'm voting here.
How do you know him? Oh, you're calling from
here. Yeah, you know Lamotta? Lamotta? She's from Bruce County. Pete Cassidy came from Bruce County. John Bagg, the Lubick from Bruce County.
And how long has he been in Portland 12 years?
Let's see. Yeah, that was some tough work. And I feel a little better, but I still have concerns that...
I got this in Bill because over the show is doing
I'm going to do 109. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to work session on Senate Bill 1009. We have the DAC 4s. These are a result of our comments this morning so that the good time provisions would only affect assault in second degree, kidnapping in second degree, robbery in second degree. And it also, didn't we have this going back to the sentence? Going back to the court, Mr. Taylor?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. The community is given a match.
Oh, it's supported.
It's supported. In that case, the person may be considered a reduction.
So this also conforms to what we've done on the right. We're on work session.
I move the dash 3.
Dash 4.
Dash
4.
Dash
4. Dr. Duncan moves the dash 4 minutes and go 109. Discussion? Objection?
Yeah, but I was going to ask, I should have asked this morning, but kidnapping in the second degree is basically kidnapping in the second degree?
Yes, Ms. Taylor.
I think it oftentimes involves this issue of custody issues. Mr. Pence, had me go look at the statute, but he got me into the statute there. And it says sometimes it's all custody issues.
Thank you.
Other questions? Objections? Anyone? Carries? Chairman would move to go 109 and 40 down. Discussion? Objection? It's my bill, so I will carry. We will now return to the work session on HB 3361 and by Representative Whitson for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I'm Representative Bill Witt. I'm here today to encourage support for House Bill 3361 and specifically the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments, which were most of it was in the original bill, which was introduced into the Judiciary Committee on the House side, make two significant changes in the bill. One, it states that any Social Security benefits or veterans benefits that are paid to the child for a disabled obligor will be offset against any remaining obligation of the obligor. And secondly, it also brings veterans benefits into the scope of Social Security benefits. We've done some research on this, and in fact, I do have a new handout here from the an organization that does legal research throughout the United States, and I'm trying to find their name here, but they looked at this issue of dollar-for-dollar credit on support obligations and found that 39 jurisdictions in the United States support obligor dollar-for-dollar credit against support obligations for Social Security, disability, and retirement benefits that are received by the child on account of the obligor's disability retirement. I think the public policy behind this is that if you have a disabled citizen who has a child support obligation, and dollars are going, that this disabled citizen has a right to, if these dollars are being paid directly to fulfill an obligation that citizen has for child support, it seems to me it's only just that you get a dollar-for-dollar offset. And currently, Oregon law does not do that. It goes into a more formal calculation, and it doesn't give any, in most cases, it doesn't give anywhere near a dollar-for-dollar benefit. So it leads to, frankly, overpaying the support and the disabled obligor having less resources to live on. The Dash 2 amendments will take care of that, and it will put in a dollar-for-dollar requirement. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Have you seen the guideline computation worksheet that has been adopted now by the state agency dealing with Social Security benefits? It ties into the current Oregon law on computing child and spousal support.
I have it one time, Mr. Chairman.
They don't give a dollar for dollar credit, but it's taken into consideration as an adjustment to the child support obligations. I no longer do domestic relations work, but I did for 15 or 16 years, and I was there when the formula first came into being. And it's basically a good formula. It's saved a lot of time and effort and frustration for both courts and the parties involved in a domestic relations divorce. So I never had a case where Social Security or Veterans benefits became an issue. So this is the first time I've seen a worksheet where it's going to invite the department to walk us through this. But at least as far as Social Security and as far as its consideration since they adopted their new rules, this does give consideration to those payments, but I do acknowledge it doesn't do it on a dollar-for-dollar basis.
Okay. And if I can, Mr. Chairman, I think the issue in front of us here with the Dash 2s is which method is most appropriate and most fair to the parties involved. If you have an obligation of $300 a month, for example, and the veterans benefit or the Social Security benefit pays $250 to the child or the custodian of the child for child support, is it appropriate not to get a $250 offset when you have a disabled citizen who's drawing these benefits? And I think as a matter of justice, I think it is appropriate to give a dollar-for-dollar offset.
The example on the guidelines is very close to what you just said as far as dollar amounts. It computes, and I'm looking at page 3, it computes the basic child support obligation at $279 per month and then deducts $230, which is the presumed Social Security benefit.
Bill, do you have that?
I don't have it in front of me, no.
Yeah, I can.
So then you deduct the $230 under the current system in Oregon, reducing the child support obligation to $49, and then based upon the earning capacity of the parent, it would require one parent to be 25 and the other 24. Then that's the formula that I was talking about in the affidavit that was used. The change that Representative Wood has suggested would be, in this case, the person who has the benefit would receive the full credit for that. And let's assume it's the obligor in this case. If that were true, then the obligor would have no child support obligation, and the obligee, or let's say is the custodial parent, would be responsible for the remainder of it. And that's the distinction.
The custodial parent would get less money, correct?
it wouldn't be significant. In this particular example, it would be $24 a month.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Obviously, with different examples, we'll get different results. So I think you can lay out a variety of examples that will show a variety of results. And I think the point the Dash 2s make is that, you know, this should be done on a dollar-for-dollar basis is the most fair way of doing it. If I can, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hoyman's had a lot more experience with this than me. Would it be okay for him to comment on the example?
Well, we took about a half an hour of testimony yesterday.
I caught a little bit of it. I saw.
So my preference at this point would be, unless you have a further comment, Representative Witt, if the committee has any questions for Representative Witt.
Actually, it's a question about this chart. Does this account at all for different, I mean, somebody could be getting disability that could have other sources of income. Does this account at all, does this treat everybody the same, regardless of their ability to pay child support?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I'm not sure. I mean, I think the point that's being made is you look at the income when you determine what is the support obligation. So, I mean, I think that's the income taken into the calculation and determining the support obligation. What we're doing is we're going one step beyond that. We're saying once the support obligation is set based upon the total income that the obligor has, what we're saying is dollars that come through veterans benefits or Social Security to support the obligees and the custodial parent, that otherwise would have gone to the obligor, the veteran or the Social Security beneficiary, should be offset dollar for dollar, because if those dollars otherwise would have flowed to the veteran or to the person receiving the Social Security.
She would, using the figures you have there, she would, his normal wife would get $24 a night.
Yes. Given that example.
Given that example.
Right.
And he would get significant money.
Well, no, he would pay $24 less.
That's it.
That would be then under that example.
Well, is that?
Okay, that doesn't deal with the veteran situation.
Okay, so
with Social Security.
It's from him to her. There's no other outside sources of money that we're talking about. The money that they currently have, right?
Well, there are other sources that are taken
that's
in.
That's what I'm trying to say.
When you begin the formula, you take, let's say what the custodial mom is making, you take then what the custodial, non-custodial father is making, and that goes into the formula. In this case, they use $1,970. So the combination of the two is $1,970. And so you see they did that for convenience, so you can see 51 and 49%, which then is the percentage that each parent would owe on what is determined by the court to be the cost of raising the child. So in this case, the obligee, assuming it's the mother, would have 51% responsibility for the cost, and the obligor 49%. And then the court makes another determination as far as what the needs, basic needs of the child are. In the case of $279. Then you deduct the Social Security payment, then you apply the formula, which means $49, $25 belongs to the custodial mother, and $24 belongs to the non-custodial father. That's how it is.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So Hoyman tells me that these are not the guidelines that are currently being used by the department.
Well, we're going to have them testify next, because if it's not, then I'd like to know what the guidelines currently are, so we'll ask them that question. The reason it's $50 at the bottom is there's a minimum $50 requirement for support, just because of all the paperwork and transfer requirements.
Finally, Mr. Chairman, we have no objection to the Dash 4 amendments, which have been introduced, and we do have a problem with the Dash 3 amendments, because they would not make this application. They'd make the application, I believe, only to future parties. It would not apply to people who are currently in the system as an obligation.
And this package's amendments deal with
taking a portion of bail money and applying it towards the court. And currently that goes into the general fund, and we'll have testimony on the effects of doing that also. Questions for Representative Rex? Thank you, Councilman.
Thank you, Mr.
I would invite Marie McKnight, David Neagle, and Ron L. Shankle to come forward. Please.
For the record, Ron L. Shankle, Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division. Clearly you understand that the issue of Social Security benefits as it relates to child support calculations is not a simple issue. And in fact, I've testified before this committee previously that we in fact had a fairly large guidelines advisory committee this past year that in reviewing the guidelines overall talked specifically about this issue and did research and a variety of calculations on this issue, and that result was the rule that went into effect March 1st regarding the consideration, standard consideration of Social Security benefits in child support calculations. The advisory committee not only had program staff, but Oregon Legal Services, other advocacy groups were represented, private sector attorneys. We tried to have the full array of people that would be interested in this topic. We did look at other states such as Idaho and Washington. We did realize that they do allow dollar-for-dollar credit. However, it's sort of mixing apples and oranges. In these other two states, they do not consider Social Security benefits to child as part of the calculation itself. They still calculate child support under their guidelines. They do allow, after the order is entered, a dollar-for-dollar credit against that obligation. In Oregon, because we use a combined income model, we look at both mother and father's incomes and assets, and the way that our calculations are done, this committee's recommendation and what was adopted through rulemaking by the program and after public hearings throughout the state was the rule that you have before you that does factor Social Security benefits into the calculation, and no, it does not allow a dollar-for-dollar credit just from the obligor's income. The logic there is we use a combined income model. Sometimes it's the father that's getting the disability or retirement. Sometimes it's the mother. And because of those various scenarios, it's not as simple always as a dollar-for-dollar credit in every case. I believe you have before you today some A6 and A7 amendments.
Could I ask one question?
Yes.
The draft that I've given to the committee, does this accurately represent the guidelines that you've presently following?
Sir Brian, it does. Those calculations were done using the guidelines in effect March 1st, 1999.
Thank you. Well, right now, I'd like to go ahead and complete this testimony.
I believe that you should have in your file from previous testimony a copy of the rulemaking that we filed with a cover sheet for the rules dated January 15th with an effective date of March 1st, and that's the scale that it was comparing the calculations against. So unless there's a calculation error, the scale was used and should be accurate. The A6 and the A7 amendments that you have before you today expand the A engrossed version of the bill for a few reasons. To clarify in the law that both administrative process and or the administrator and the court should be able to offer these various remedies. And the amendments both expand the language to allow for modifications when Social Security benefits were not previously considered, or maybe they were considered, but it was done prior to March 1st when we came up with the standardized formula, so they may have been considered in a very different manner.
And the importance of this is it gives someone then another bite of the apple if the Social Security benefits weren't considered, so you can go back and try again. So in Mr. Hulman's situation, if you felt that the judge applied these in error or wasn't aware, then it would give you an opportunity to go back and say, I'd like to raise that issue again. But you don't have that the statute at that time. So, well, it's once you enact the statute, that becomes the law.
Sure, Brent, we would agree with what you just said. A further issue in this bill is that of allowing credit against past support for the issue of Social Security benefits. The A engrossed version delegates rulemaking authority to the Child Support Program to allow credit for retroactive lump sum payments made to a child. The dialogue that we had with the House Judiciary Committee on Civil Law and our understanding of what they felt was important was there are times that either parent applies for disability through Social Security, and it takes several months for the Social Security Administration to make that determination on not only how much the parent will receive, but how much the child will receive. Even if those obligors or obligees were to come forward and ask us for a modification, they can't yet tell us until Social Security Administration finishes their process how much that will impact, and we cannot figure it into the calculation. So there's language in that bill that would allow us, in those scenarios where at no fault of the parties, they weren't able to give us a number to use for Social Security benefits, we could go back, have a rule to allow some type of credit for that instance.
And those lump sum payments, I've only done one of these in my 26 years, but for Social Security disability, it took months. And then finally, it was, you said you did it, and then it was several months later before you got the lump sum payment, where it went retroactive back to the date that you, I think you filed the claim.
And that's our understanding as well.
And so what this would do in those situations, you could adjust to that type of a credit.
That is correct.
Okay.
Now, this is where the A6 and A7 amendments start to vary. In the A6 amendments, it replaces this retroactive language with a credit against arrears accruing after March 1st. So instead of looking at just those cases where there's some sort of lump sum, in simplistic terms, it would allow a person to come forward and ask for a credit against past support at any point after March 1st when we did have a standardized calculation for Social Security benefits in place in Oregon. The A7 amendment maintain that retroactive lump sum language and add the administrative authority, but it does not put into place the modification option. The difference there is in the way that the program approaches modifications. Modifications are requested for a large array of reasons, Social Security benefits just being one possible item. In most scenarios, when you have a modification remedy available, the parties can come forward and take that modification, and we will begin to facilitate that action. If the parties do not choose to come forward for whatever reason, and 3 months, 6 months, 9 months later, ask for a modification and say, oh yes, by the way, 6 months ago it really changed, we do not offer them relief. We feel that if we offered relief specific to Social Security benefits in that modification arena, we would be doing something different than we do on all of our other modification actions. So that's why that language varies somewhat between the two, and other people at the table will be able to speak to that as well. We would respectfully request the Child Support Program that you adopt the A7 amendments. We believe these amendments are a middle ground between the efforts of all of the people that the Child Support Program brought together to look at the issue of Social Security benefits and the issues that were raised before the legislators, your committee as well as the House committee from various constituents this session. We further believe these amendments will offer a remedy to most of the constituents who have come forward without putting something into the law that could possibly negatively impact other constituents who have not come before you and have different case scenarios, such as the scenario where it's the custodial parent getting the Social Security benefits. Both the A6 and the A7s blend in the issue of veterans benefits because it's our understanding that it is the wish of the committee to consider those benefits, and we will do whatever you direct us to do in that area. One further point about the differences between the A6 and A7 amendments and previous amendments is that in ORS 107-135, the existing law uses the term may, sticking to allowing the court and administrator allowing credit. And the amendments, one set of amendments before you in A2 would change that to shall. We feel that removing the discretion that the judges currently have based on the merit of an individual case, again, could have a negative impact on other cases that have not been brought forward before you so that you can think about the different scenarios, and then it might have a significant impact on the families of Oregon.
So you prefer to leave the word may rather than shall?
Sir Brandt, that is correct.
Thank you. Question? Why don't we hear from the whole panel then, because they're going to be discussing these amendments, and then we'll
Next to me is Jean Fogarty, our general counsel attorney, who is available for questions, but I don't know if you were going to make any general comments.
I'm just here for lawyer questions. I know Maureen McKnight has some prepared testimony. Chair Grant, members of the committee, I've circulated or distributed just a summary, and I'll just try to highlight the points here. I believe what Ms. Schenkel said at the beginning and what Chair Brian indicated is really critical, that we have a calculation, a way to calculate Social Security on the front end of the system, and what the retroactive dollar-for-dollar approach does in giving a credit is a backdoor treatment of what Oregon has chosen to do in a front-door manner. And we would oppose the dollar-for-dollar credit for some of the reasons listed in my testimony, having to do with it really addresses one component of the calculation and doesn't take into account the fact that the benefit that the child receives is really an asset in the family, and it's not just to be countered by the obligor's child support obligation. The approach taken in the calculation under the rule is really the appropriate way to do it, and there was a lot of thought going into that, and that's the approach that should be taken. And these other states that have retroactive credits don't necessarily allow a front-end solution to how to deal with Social Security. So in terms of it being an idea that you consider the benefit when you're setting the award, I think it's true that individuals in this constituent situation need to be treated as any other parent receiving Social Security. And prior to March of this year, there was really no way to uniformly consider the receipt of Social Security benefits. Decisional law was really across the board. You could do it in rebuttal, but you don't have to. And really, people were not treated the same way. And it would be, I think it's very appropriate to allow individuals who had support obligations considered prior to March and had their orders considered in a Social Security benefit context without the benefit of the rule to be able to now be treated the same way that people filing after March are. And that's what the -6 and -7 do. And as Ms. Schenkel indicated, they also allow the agency to make these kind of modification orders. The difference between the -6 and the -7, and let me just say I can certainly live with the -7, has to do with how to treat and how to address the situation of an individual who can certainly go in now if we pass this right to go back and get the recalculation. That person will have the new treatment under the new rule prospectively, but they won't have their situation addressed prior to their going in under this new statute or this new rule. And the dash six is some attempt to allow them to seek a credit back to March of this year. But I don't disagree with Ms. Schenkel in terms of what breadth there would be in terms of granting satisfactions under that year. And to the extent the child support program rules to be adopted pursuant to either -6 or -7 would be restricted in their use of the credit and consider factors that make sure an obligee isn't hit with an overpayment and we're not satisfying support that exceeds whether we're not satisfying support that was from the time before Social Security was even applied for. I can certainly live with the -7. I think the bottom line is that we have a very thoughtful approach to doing this, and while we understand other states have taken a different approach, they don't necessarily have our front door treatment of the issue, and we want to get people in the front door on this and not do it after the fact. So I can live with the -7s, and as I say, they a difference in the -6 in just one respect.
And that respect, again, is, I want to make sure the committee understands this. If you could explain in layman terms the difference between the A6 and the A7.
The A7s, by their terms, allow the child support program to adopt rules to allow for credit for the receipt of Social Security benefits by an obligor, when the benefit is received because of a disability or retirement of that parent. There isn't a time limit condition on when that benefit had to have been received. It isn't tied into March of 99 for any reason. They have the discretion and the rulemaking authority to take those kinds of cases into account, but as well as to take into account other equities that might arise or might have arisen prior to March of this year. So there isn't a limitation in time for what the agency might choose or the conditions the agency might choose to impose on the credit to be granted.
Mr. Chairman, is that the dash 7?
That's the dash 7. It's a broader grant, in essence, of discretion for rulemaking authority, but it's my understanding the agency has and is prepared to commit to some guidelines in terms of what their approaches would be.
And how long does it take to normally adopt rules?
Mr. Bryant, routinely we go through approximately a 90-day process. However, we have the ability, should this become law, to enter a temporary rule to get it into place much sooner, I believe within 30 days, and then go through the more formal process of gathering public comment and doing a permanent rule after the temporary rule is out there.
And so I understand. I'm the one who asked the 6 and 7 to be prepared because I wanted to include the vesting benefits and also do something for the situation of people who got caught in between when the rules will be adopted in their last modification hearing. The DAS 7s, if the department shows, could be much broader in their application and do more then because you wouldn't be as limited to what the DAS A6s provide.
If I may, Chair Bryant, I agree with what Ms. McKnight said about the DAS 7s, except with, she said there was no time limitation. This only would affect those cases where there was a retroactive lump sum of benefits. As opposed to the DAS 6, it would allow a credit at any time going back to March 1st. So even if you should have filed your motion for modification in January and you waited until October, you could still go back and get that credit. And from the program's point of view, we feel that contrary to the encouragement of timely filing of modification. So that's why we would prefer the credit just for the retroactive lump sum situation. We're really, it's nobody's fault other than the slowness of the Social Security Administration as to why that person couldn't get in and get the modification they needed.
Sure, so you prefer the dash 7.
Yes.
Well, it's hard to read the two and see the distinction, too. Questions for these witnesses? Thank you, Mr. Swank. I think you had comments on the dash 4s. These again are the ones suggested by Patrick.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office, and I'm here today actually to provide you with information about the Dash 4 amendments. We haven't taken a position, but it's an issue that we confront regularly because it deals with monies coming from the courts and going to the legislatures, and there are some issues that would probably help you make the policy decision that underlies what's represented by the Dash 4 amendments. The Dash 4 amendments basically take money that is forfeited by somebody who fails to appear on bail and use that money to pay for support if that person owes bail or owes support. Now, let me explain to you the potential ramifications of that. Since 1995, the legislature created a single revenue stream from the courts for all monies that come out of the criminal side of the court. And all of those monies go into a single account. That's called the Criminal Fines and Assessments Account, out of which the legislature funds various programs, 12 programs currently, one of which is the money going to the general fund. But the other programs include the BPSP, which gets 100% of its funding from the Criminal Injury Compensation Account, Mental Health DUI funds. The state police gets some money. If there's money for child abuse, domestic violence fund gets money from that. Special money for services and implied consent. The child trust endowment fund gets money from that. There's money for a safety education fund. The domestic violence fund gets money from that. And there are other sources that get money from that. Now, 100% of the money that come out of the criminal side of the court go to that fund. That includes all monies from forfeited bail. So when somebody forfeits bail, currently it goes to that fund. That fund is in the general fund, but the Department of Revenue distributes those monies out of that fund before anything is paid to the general fund out of that fund. So that's how the money goes. Now, the amendments that are proposed would take money out of that revenue stream to use it for another purpose. and that's something you should do, but we thought you might like to want to know who that's going to affect and how much it's going to affect them if you want to make that decision. Because we work closely during the course of the session with the Ways and Means Committee. One of the things that setting up the criminal fines and assessments account has allowed the legislature to do is to fund programs that they want to, and to have a predictable revenue source for these programs that they're interested in, the domestic violence and the other thing. In fact, generally what they do is they add a new program for that by increasing the amount of money that goes into the criminal fines and assessments account and then funding new programs out of it. Now, my revenue person, the revenue person over at the Judicial Department, tells me that the amount during the last biennium that was forfeited or in bail was approximately $3.229 million. So that's how much is going from forfeited bail into the client criminal fines and assessments account. Now, the next logical question is, well, if we're taking this from criminals who are failing to show up for their trial, how many of those criminals owe child support and have arrearages on it? Now, that's a question I can't answer, and I have no way to tell you that. If you assume that most of these criminals don't have children or don't owe child support, or if they owe child support, they're current on paying their child support, that they're reasonably good parents, then you're not going to lose much money out of the stream. If you assume that they have children or that they're in arrears on child support, and my guess would be that there's somebody that's assuming from the Dash 4 amendments that there's a pile of money there that they can go get, and that's why they want the Dash 4 amendments, then you may be taking a fair amount of money out of this stream that would otherwise go to these programs. I can give you some comparisons to give you an idea. This session, there are three bills that were introduced by to add new programs, and what they did was they created a $5 increase in the unitary assessment, which is another source of money that goes into the criminal fines and assessments account. And that $5 increase in unitary assessment would generate about $2.843 million, out of which they are funding a bill for Senator Timms that creates an emergency medical services enhancement account for rural areas. Senator Keetub had a bill, Senate Bill 1202, I believe, creates new money for sexual assault victims from a fund that's being funded out of the CFAA, Criminal Fines and Assessments account. Representative Westland had a new public safety memorial fund that provided a safety net for the families of officers who were killed in the course of duty. And if all of the money that was forfeited from the bails were taken out of this revenue stream, you'd actually be taking more out of the revenue stream than the $5 increase in unitary assessment is adding to it this session. Now, I give you this information because you've got a policy decision to make. We believe in the Judicial Department that you should be making the policy decision about who gets the money that comes from the courts. But we also understand that you don't want to have unintended consequences of the actions that you take when you play with revenue streams. That's why I give you the background. Now, some other minor things that I want to mention are some alternatives. Potentially, there's another source of, if you want to find some money in this area for child support, there is an area that has been tapped slightly, but you might want to look at. When somebody posts bail and they show up, they get the bail back. Well, that's a source of money. If they owe child support rather than giving them the security amount back, you may want to give that amount first to child support. And that's something that can currently be done under the statutes, but there's nothing in the statute that establishes a priority for that. So if this is a need that you want to address, that's a place that you may want to get some money. A technical issue that I would mention is that in either instance, if you do the Dash 4 amendments or the alternative that I've talked about, one of the problems is the courts don't know when there's a child support obligation, because it may be from another county, another state, it may be SED. So you need to put in that if somebody wants the money spent in that way, that somebody needs to file a motion with the court to get the court to suggest that the court may want to do this, even if the court is going to have discretion, which, coming from the courts, I think they should have. But somebody needs to file a motion with the court. My last suggestion was if you actually follow through with the Dash A4 amendments, you may want to think about the way the Dash A4 amendments are drafted currently. If you take this money to pay the child support obligation, taking state money to pay a private obligation, and you're leaving the state with no judgment on the money that it's paid so it could ultimately collect on the person, which may be something that you want to think about. It may be difficult to get the money, but if they have the money for the bail to begin with. So those are alternatives to think about and things that can affect the policy decision that you're approaching. And we have dealt a lot with the CFAA and the Ways and Means Committee, and I know that they're concerned about this question, so one of the reasons I'm bringing this information forward is so you have the information when you make your decision. I can answer any questions that you've got about this. And it's going to come up on another bill that's on your agenda later. So,
other questions? Senator Rudy.
Is it fair to say that the impact of this would be more than $50,000?
Senator Burdick, it would shift more than, it could potentially shift more than $50,000 from one recipient to another. I don't know that it would, because I don't know how many dependents owe child support, but potentially, yes, it could be more than $50,000.
I would feel very cautious in adopting the Dash 4 just because I know with the increased military assessment and where that money goes, normally when there's the threat of any decrease in that fund, it raises a rejoinder from numerous sources. And we'd have to figure out exactly what the impact might be before we move forward on this. However, the idea of allowing someone to file a motion to seize the bail for delinquent support where it's not forfeited, that makes good sense to me.
I'd be willing to work with you on those amendments.
Okay. All right, well, you'll have to work quickly because my committee shuts down on Friday. Other questions? Ms. Siegel, did you have anything to add, or did Maureen state your cause out of here?
Hey, Brian. David Niebel from the Oregon Law Center. Ms. McKnight stated my position quite well, I thought. I just wanted to point out with respect to the Dash A4 amendments that the general fund actually gets about over 45% of the criminal fine and assessment account. So it would also have an effect not only to the various claimants to the fund, but also to the general fund. And as a person who represents one of the claimants to that fund, the Domestic Violence Coalition, I, as Mr. Swank suggested, and in fact you have suggested, was take sort of a dim view of reducing the amount of money in the fund. Thank you.
Committee, that will it'll take a day to draft those amendments. So my thinking would be to not move the bill in work session today, but it's scheduled tomorrow.
Tim, does anybody want 1 hour notice now?
Oh,
sure.
Pardon? Do one so that the if you show up, you can file a motion to grab the bail. But not on the bail is forfeited, that it's actually there and available. I think that'd be a step in the direction of the dashboard. Mm-hmm. Other comments?
Mr. Chair, we're not going to tap the unitary assessment thing. Is that the
version? Yeah, we're going to leave that alone. I'm sure that someone would have figured this out very quickly, and suddenly our votes on the floor would just
turn. That's not a bottom of the floor.
I'll give you just a couple of minutes, and then we need to go on to another bill. If you'd like to comment on the Dash 6 or 7 amendment.
Chair, Senators,
My name is Dennis Lehman, record. In the dash 6 and 7 amendments, I didn't see them until a few minutes, so I went back 4 times looking for these, and they weren't there until after I testified, so I wasn't able to testify to them before. I'm looking at these. On the dash 7, I'm looking at part of it I agree with and part of it I do not agree with. The 1 through 12, I would agree with on the dash 7. It looks really good, except for line 6. They're leaving out the word calculation in there, and I think that's an important thing in the calculation thing. On line 13 and 14, I don't understand what that means. In line 45, they say delete the comma and insert a colon. There is no comma. The colon's already there, and for what are we supposed to be inserting on the last page? I don't understand what that is.
Probably just on the substance is where we need your comments.
That's substance. I totally disagree with the 8-6 amendment. It almost nullifies any part of bill what we put in. It's in total contradiction to our 8-2 amendment. On almost every item here. I didn't have much of a chance to look at these. I just found these a few minutes ago.
Well, towards the end of the session, and then come very close.
Very quickly.
Thank you for your comments. Yes. We will close then the work session on 3361, and we'll close the work session on 2226, and you have the dash 17.
And we have the dash A-17 amendments. And if I could walk through them and tell you which one. What they do, this bill requires, basically seems to require the public or private officials to report a new failure and reason to believe the use of lines of contact and policy officials' duties. This allows private course of action and violation. We leave in the disallowed private course of action, but we do remove from arising from the contact and the course of the official duties. It also does the following. As it relates to firefighters, we qualify that those are only canine firefighters and volunteer firefighters. So volunteer firefighters do not have the same reporting obligations that a paid firefighter has. On line 34, we have dental hygienists, so they have to be included in the bill so that they will have to report the private contact. On lines 40 to 45 and page 3 of the bill, we then add and insert the reporting section of 419B110, and we make a slight change in the first two paragraphs, and basically the bullet language is taken from below, that's current language, but we add the official as usual responsibility as well. Then going further down, we then go to lines 22 through 24, and what we do is we increase the penalty fine from $1,000 to $10,000, and we extend the penalty to basically 161.665 cap using the fines and infractions. Then we create any fines collected under the subsection that is deposited in the criminal injury compensation account. Then we go on. Violations of this section does not give rise to private right of action or claim to be made. That's the bill as it came to us from the House. Then we add, and this is suggested that the Department of Justice, this subsection does not bar or restrict a private right of action or claim for relief based on a failure to report suspected abuse of a child or breaches a duty other than created by subsection 1 of the section. Let me give an example, Mr. Chair. For example, in the situation that we've heard about a lawyer, if the lawyer's client says, my father's abusing you, I want you to report this. Then there would be a duty arising from the attorney-client relationship. However, if the situation as we heard before us with the doctor and Salem, there would be no civil liability because that duty arose from the statutory obligation to report. For that, I believe that the language is there for. Then we go on subsection 4, which is a provision that the person violates subsection 1 of the section, either the state agency that licenses or registers the person or the employer, the person may take the disciplinary action against the person. So it includes not only that we have in the original amendment to licensees, but disciplinary action against the employee. So that would put licensees definitely mostly the state and local government on also legal footing there, but he didn't. Let me go on to line subsection 5. Okay, this helps with some reporting on these concerns by the district attorneys and FDF that how do you report this? And this is from a law enforcement agency, the State Office of Services for Children and Families, that there is no cause to believe that a person who failed to report is required by subsection 1 of this section. The law enforcement agency or the state official shall notify the employer of the person or the agency that the licensee registers. The license agency that licenses or registers the person.
Sure.
Yes, and how?
Law enforcement has expressed a little bit of concern about subsection 5. I'm wondering if they could be given a couple of minutes to voice their concerns about subsection 5.
Yes, we'll allow them to do that. Why don't we go ahead and walk through the rest of the bill and then I'll invite them on.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Committee, this is the applicability day here that says it applies to actions or actions occurring before, on, or after the effective date. Excuse me, that's every provision about subsection 2, and that's the liability issue. The amendment to 419B01 by subsection 2 of the 1990 Act do not affect any action commenced before the effective date of this 1999 Act. So if you follow the claim of action based on a failure to report child abuse unexpected prior to the effective date of this Act, you could do. After the effective date, if you file a claim of action, you would no longer have a cause of action arising from the effective date of the report. Mr. Chairman, the committee, the last provision is actually so that if the person does make a report, what happens if you make a report in good faith, you are free from liability. So if someone reports child abuse, they are facing liability. However, it is ambiguous as to whether they are under the Tort Claims Act, and it's ambiguous as to whether they would be suspended. So that if you are a state employee now, and you file a report, the employee agent is informed that sort of considered was made scope of the officer's duties, employee's agent's informed the duties for the purposes of the bill comes out. So because the bill has these amendments would require 24-hour reporting, this basically says that if you had 24-hour reporting, you have 24-hour protection under the Tort Claims Act, which includes the duty to defend. That's it, Mr. Chairman.
And that will off duty police department. Committee, I've been in negotiations with Mark Gibson on this, and he has reviewed them, and some of the changes that are in here were at his request to make this obtain the necessary constitutional signature. Also, we've agreed that in the interim, the interim disciplinary committee will take a look at this subject because it doesn't make sense to hold, for instance, a doctor, a scientist working in a lab all day, to the same standard that a doctor in an emergency room might, who has more experience and more occasion to see abuse. Likewise, if you're a CPA, who's audit tax attorney or an attorney who's a tax attorney should be held to a different standard than an attorney who in fact deals in domestic relations and juvenile delinquency matters. That's difficult to massage, but it needs to be done. I think the same would be true in law enforcement, different assignments that the officers have, and right now it's just blanket. And what we've realized in the bar is that under the current statute, one, we don't have the training for it. Two, most of us, until this came before this committee, should recognize what our responsibility was and that you could be sued if you didn't. So education has got to be an important part of this, too, and how to do that is something that we'll look into. Until that's done, the dental hygienists have requested that they not become a part of this bill and require a reporter. Line 6 and 7, we will come out. But with that, let me first, Russ, do you want to come forward and talk about 5 and he has it for you, or would you two go on the mic and come forward?
I'm on.
Okay. You've been delegated the responsibility.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Russ Spencer for the Oregon Sheriff. And actually, I think you'll probably want to hear from Mr. Armstrong separately.
I know how welcome it is to come and bring concerns at the last moment. In my defense, I just received a copy of these amendments, and my concern is just simply this. With Section 5, when we talk about when a law enforcement agency and so forth has reasonable cause to believe, my question is simply this. Are we now creating potential liability for law enforcement agencies or officers? Where we solve one liability problem further in the bill, are we creating a new one here? And would it be appropriate to extend the same liability protections to the agencies that contact employers as we are offering to the mandated reporters? And you can send me your thank you card later, Bill.
Okay. And how would you do that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm just a simple country lobbyist. Okay. And not the, don't possess the erudite legal skills that this committee does.
Can you see a quick way to do that?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. And violations of this section do not give rise to private cause of action. Of the subsection, we get the language in the bill of subsection 3, violation of subsection 5. This does not give rise to private violations of subsection 1 of this section does not. How about violations of subsection 1 or subsection 5?
I think that would do it.
Very happy with that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Frank. Now, I got your letter and I read it, and I was angry at first. You have to find me a solution.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, for the record, my name once again was still from the state court of Minnesota. And we're talking about the A-17 amendment. Let me explain my concern about the A-17 amendment. Say that there's one sentence starting this on line 24 of page 1 and running through line 2 of page 2. As I was just up here a minute ago, I explained to you, first of all, let me explain we have two concerns. One concern is sort of a cost-benefit concern, and that affects us just as the courts, and how much we're going to have to pay to implement this, and whether or not the benefit is, in your estimation, worth it. The second one is more of a policy decision about the precedent that this would set. On the first one, this says any fines collected under this subsection shall be deposited in the criminal injury compensation account. Established under 147-225. As I was just up here a minute ago explaining to you, currently all of the monies that we get from the criminal side of the courts go into the criminal fines and assessments account. And it's a very simple accounting procedure. We get the money, we put it in the account, and we give it to you so you can decide how it gets paid out. This would require a certain number of offenses to be identified, first of all, among the millions of other transactions that the courts handle, and we literally handle millions in a biennium, to be identified, the money from those transactions identified and segregated and treated differently than the other monies that we handle. And I've talked to our information systems to division people about this kind of thing. One of the reasons that we set up the criminal fines and assessments account originally was so that we didn't have to do this, because before 1995, there were numbers of different accounts where little pots of money went here and here, and you had to have a clerk say, well, let's see, there's so much of this fine goes to the BCSST, and so much of this fine goes to the state police, so much of this fine goes to the Senate. It was an accounting nightmare. And the criminal fines and assessment accounts remove the need to do all of that. And so now we just take money and put it in the account. This would mean that we would have to create a new system for identifying these monies, treating them differently, and paying them differently. And we've got 36 court locations in this state. So first of all, we're going to have to do some programming on our computerized accounting system. And we're going to have to work to program out, make sure it works, take each of the court locations and get it handed in their computers, make sure it works with their computers, and make sure that the staff there are trained to identify this particular thing and treat it differently than everything else we treat. Now, because we've got 36 court locations, as you can imagine, if it only takes $500 at each location and people's time for training and those sorts of things, you've got $15,000. That's the beginning, depending upon how much it costs. So that's a concern with us. That ties into the benefit Now, you're going to raise, even though you've raised the potential maximum fine to $10,000 here, the real possibility of a whole bunch of people getting charged $10,000 is probably remote as a practical matter.
Right.
And, or of this getting cited even a whole lot.
Yeah. Let me do this.
Okay.
So this, what we proposed here wouldn't work. And I understand your reason, because of the cost and the training, and it's in the same direction that we got rid of in 1995. Currently, if there is a victim who has been abused, from what fund do they receive money?
Right. Well, they receive money from the Criminal Injuries Compensation Account, which receives money from the CFAA, where this money would go if it goes to regular tracks. The CFAA, the Criminal Injuries Compensation Account is one of the recipients of funds from the Criminal Fines and Assessments Account, where this fine money would go anyway. And it's budgeted into their account every session. So I believe that if you either eliminated the session, the sentence that I'm talking about, that fund would still receive money from the proceeds of these fines, or if you specifically designated the Criminal Fines and Assessments Account, that money would also, the criminal victims would also be getting money, along with the other programs that receive money from that account, the abused children.
Which of the two accounts would provide the most money for victims?
Well, it depends upon whether or not you include the domestic violence fund as providing money. And there are other accounts that receive money from the CFAA that provide monies for victims. But the most money is, I don't know. Because I don't know how many people are going to be cited under this and how much money you're going to generate. That's the cost benefit part of this. My guess is there's not going to be a whole lot of money specifically.
Right. So if we deleted that sentence, it would still go to victims, but it wouldn't just be focused on this particular group.
Right.
And they would have access to the larger pool of money
that's
available
if
you can just...
Chairman of the committee, does that mean that both the minimum and the same zone starting July 24, the bold language, any fine collected in the subsection shall be and continue to issue deposits in the form of compensation Congress
$147.55? Right. Because they can't do it, it'll just go into the general victim fund. Yeah, Mr. Swain. And I understand by deleting that's where the money would go.
Chairman of the committee, I understand the amendments to the amendment to be page 1, page 1, section 7, but then the identity cannot be reported with. Then I'm going to take one again on line 24, which I understand the goal language. We remove the goal language on 1 and 2, lines 1 and 2 of page 2. Then we're going to line 4, violation of subsection 1 or subsection 5 of this section. Does not give rise to a cause of action, so we'll be adding four subsections.
That's true. Senator Braley wanted to be here for this particular bill, so let's bring it back at 8 tomorrow morning.
Jeremy?
Yes.
It was my understanding that we might be able to send the bill out if you wanted to file something in writing for it.
Right.
Okay.
Technically, she needs to be here to do that.
Okay.
So we'll bring it back tomorrow.
Because I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. But you need someone to join with you. And you're going to vote in favor of the bill, aren't you? You're not? Oh, I thought you were. Okay, we can do it now. Okay. Okay. Then the chair would move the following conceptual amendment to the dash A-17 of HB 2226, that a deletion of lines 6 and 7 on page 1, a deletion beginning on page 1, line 24, that begins and finds collected, continuing on page 2 through line 2 that ends under or as 147.255, and an addition on page 2, line 4, after the parenthesis 1, say, or paren 5. That's the conceptual amendment to the dash A-17. Discussion? Objection? The chair then would move the dash A-17 amendments to House Bill 2226
discussion? Chair then would move House Bill 2226 as amended before it is passed. Discussion?
I may, if you need to vote, if you could vote to get it for, I would do that, but I also have some reservations that are now from all sorts of directions. And,
okay.
Put that right.
Got it. Do you vote for the motion to move it along?
No.
Thank you. But Senator Burdick and Senator Courtney will vote no. So indicate them as no. Motion carries. I will carry and they serve notice possible minorities. Well, if it's possible, we'll see.
Recording the big data.
We could do, okay. We'll try and do one more here. We'll open up the session on 2307. And, Ingrid, we have, is Middleton here too?
Mr. Chair, he was here, and so he may have left. I do have some comments from him.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Ingrid Johnson, Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. There are dash 10 and 11 amendments that we need to prepare. With respect to the dash 10 amendments, that they may explain what they do, Mr. Chair. This has to do with instant assault, and the offense which is involves the physical injury to a child under the age of 3, which is caused by reckless conduct of the defendant. That conduct under current law would be a Class C misdemeanor. The bill, as it came to this committee, would make that a Class B felony. So it would move from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class B felony, placed at Category 8 on the guidelines grid. So it would be a significant change. The amendments, the A10 amendments, would add another element to the crime in order for it to be elevated to a Class B felony. And that element would be that it would have to create a significant risk of serious physical injury. So the elements of the crime would be physical injury only, not serious physical injury occurring to the child due to the reckless conduct of the defendant, but under circumstances which created the significant risk of serious physical injury. And if you want me to give you an example of that, I can do that.
Please.
So if a person acts recklessly, it's with a known disregard of a substantial risk that something's going to happen. So it's not just an accident, but it's reckless behavior. It says, I'm not paying much attention here. I know there's a risk, but I'm going to disregard it. And then, as a result of that conduct, in child under 3, which is the physical injury. The law, there's a lot of injuries that qualify as physical injuries. They can be as minor as a cut, a scratch, a bruise, a headache. They can be as major as anything that isn't life-threatening. So a significant wound, a significant injury of some kind. There's a big range of those things. And so the amendment says that not only must you have those two pieces, but the conduct involved has to occur in a set of circumstances where there was a significant risk that serious physical injury would occur. So it's under a set of circumstances that a person would say, in this set of circumstances, the conduct was such that you might have expected a much worse injury than happened. Fortunately, it wasn't a bad injury, but it could have been. Now I have to tell you that after Mr. Penn and I discussed this, we did come to an agreement as to what this might look like in a way that would satisfy him. And it is slightly different, and it hasn't been drafted, but it would say, under circumstances creating a risk of serious physical injury that a reasonable person would perceive as more than a remote risk. And it might mean something to lawyers. All of that is a way of avoiding trying to define the word significant risk, which is otherwise kind of undefined in the criminal law. So say, the risk has to be one that a reasonable person would say, well, it's not just a slight chance that serious physical injury would occur, but there's more than a slight chance that that would have happened under these circumstances. So we have submitted that to legislative council.
Well, I hope they come up with
I'm afraid that that was their suggestion, Mr. Chairman.
Oh.
Gravity is a cold one. Okay.
Does the chair wish to hear about the A11s, or shall we postpone that until we...
No, tell me about the A11s, since you're here, and they're your amendments.
I will, and I know Mr. Penn does not concur.
Right.
In the current bill, there are two crimes committed, two new crimes that are created, excuse me. One is a Class A felony. And that one involves reckless causing of serious physical injury to a child under three. So those are the three elements of this crime. Reckless conduct by the defendant, serious physical injury to the child, which means either life-threatening or permanent damage to a bodily organ or loss of function to a bodily organ. So it's long-term serious physical injury. Plus the child has to be under three. Under current law, that conduct would be either a Class A misdemeanor or a Class C felony. If you had only those elements, we're talking about a misdemeanor or a Class C felony, which is a non-Measure 11 offense. And it probably would not require a prison term under many circumstances. This bill would elevate that crime to a Class A felony, the most serious form of felony offense, and would create a presumptive prison term of 70 months.
Yes.
Does that mean it's about 11? Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, no, it does not, because the 70 months would not be a minimum sentence, so that the court could depart upwards or downwards from that sentence. It would be subject to the court's discretion, but the court would be required to impose it unless there were circumstances that made it an inappropriate sentence in that particular case. So it would be the presumed sentence. But so the amendments which I propose would add another element to the crime, so that instead of three, there would be four. The fourth element would be that it would have to be a set of circumstances which manifested an indifference to the value of human life. This is an additional part of the mental element, and it's already defined in the assault statutes, and indeed it is used as an element to aggregate assaults under the assault statute, so it's a known quantity. But it requires more than recklessness. Instead of just being reckless, you have to be reckless under circumstances manifesting an indifference to the value of human life. So whoever's committing this conduct isn't just reckless, but is basically indifferent to what happens to this child. Mm-hmm. Now, under current...
I'm sorry, I interrupted. It's mm-hmm. sort of extreme indifference.
I'm sorry, that's correct.
Okay, is that also in the...
It is. Mr. Chair, can I read it? Yes, that's the current thing. Extreme indifference to the value of human life. Under current law, if you have those elements, if you have reckless causing of serious physical injury with extreme indifference to the value of human life, that is a Class C. So, again, you're elevating this two whole categories beyond what ordinary assault would be. And I understand that we're talking about small children, and they can't testify about their injuries and those kinds of things, but it seems disproportionate. So in
your amendments in A11 would elevate it one class rather than two.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, and I think because you add the under three, you are adding a new element, and so it makes some sense to aggregate the offense because of that new element.
Ms. Lennon, are you here on this bill? Oh, well, it's okay. Fits in your daily work, doesn't it? Spend your afternoon differently.
I'm working on fiscal impacts as I listen, Mr. Chair. I'm here to listen to the distinctions being drawn between these bills because our job is to contact DAs and try to estimate the number of cases and the corrections impact of these changes. But if you have questions about the guidelines, I'd be glad to try to answer.
I don't think it would be because there aren't a lot of these cases, as I understand it. They are quite significant when they do take place.
The current impact estimate is about 68 beds by the end of the next biennium under the current language of the bill, Mr. Chair.
And that's quite a few. That is. The Section 4, do you have any thoughts on that where you have the presumptive sentence? Do we do presumptive sentences on other suicide crimes?
Mr. Chair, presumptive sentence is a term used in the guidelines that is the base sentence, and then a judge is required to find a substantial and compelling reason to either increase or decrease that sentence. So to go up or down, the judge finds a substantial and compelling reason. We call that a departure. It is not a term that has been applied outside the guidelines, except when we worked on the sentencing guidelines bill with the State v. Bagley sticks. We did set those as presumptive sentences. But we're trying to, my understanding of what happened on the House side was that this bill started out to make these crimes Measure 11 offenses, and rather than have those a mandatory minimum sentence to give the judge some discretion, those were made presumptive sentences. So they took the numbers from Measure 11, but made those presumptive so the judges do have some discretion. But it's not something we have a lot of experience with or know exactly how the courts will view that.
Sure, no question.
And it's really either of you, under the A11 amendments, if something is called in the second degree is classified as a Class C felony. I know this is technically possible, but it wouldn't really make sense to classify it as a crime category 8 on the grid, correct? Because that would not, in some cases, potentially be exceeding the maximum determined sentence, isn't that right?
Mr. Chair and Counsel, yes, that's correct. And in my amendments, the A11s, I hadn't mentioned, but I'd like to point out to you that it's the least Section 4 altogether, which would mean that the Criminal Justice Commission would rank these offenses, and they say would be presumptive terms rather than any kind of mandatory term.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you add the other criterion of extreme indifference to the value of human life, off the top of your head, does that have any impact on the 68 beds impact?
Senator Burke, yes. I had a brief conversation with Mr. Penn earlier while he was here, and he thought that would be a substantial, dramatic limitation on the number of cases that would fall into this bill.
Thank you.
But typically the process we use is we take the language, we fax it to a few DA offices and say, now how many cases do you think fall under this and what kind of disposition do you think you would get? And then we try to lump that into a statewide impact estimate for you. So.
Thank you. I'm glad you were here. We'll take a look at that amended language tomorrow, and we'll also take a look at the 8, 10, and 11 you've given us the thought. You got those, so I need to say. Committee, another day of hard work.
This isn't the kind of vote that you do, but just so you know, I don't think you go back and ask to change your vote on an amendment as opposed to finding what outcome is the option. But if I could, I would change my vote on the -9 amendments to HGR 52, because I have to admit, since I cast that vote, I do think I'm now taken by the comment of Senator Brown, and she pointed out that even though I disagreed vehemently with the vote twice the votes have been asked to come up with this constitutional change so that local governments can have the authority to zone these kinds of businesses, and they lost. And just as I thought it was unwise for us to send the bill, the issue back to voters to the suicide, even though I opposed the suicide measure, I do think the voters should be given as much opportunity as possible, given the fact that twice it turns out to make a decision on that ordinance. And so your amendment, which I voted against, and I wish I had voted for, which would put it on in November of 2000, is the time when most Oregonians will have a chance to vote on. So I don't, I'm making a note of that. I don't know whether you allow to change your vote on an amendment or not. If you are. If you are, then I'd like the record to reflect that on the dash 9 amendments to HJR 52, I was a no. I am a yes on that vote. So I think,
Mr. Sharon, I'm sorry you're by yourself on that.
Okay, well, I'm wrong, but I've been wrong.
The first time now, I'm wrong the second time we see
that, but I'd like the record to show that.
Without objection, we'll allow Senator Courtney to change his vote to aye on the dash 89. Board, we are adjourned. And again, thank you for your vote.